The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, Russ Baker from whowhatwhy.com is going to be talking about what's going on in Egypt and what's happened to their leaders since the fall, and maybe talk about some of the things that have been going on around in this country, maybe some discussion about putting folks who have crashed our economy behind bars. In the second hour, Norman Caulfield, author of NAFTA and Labor in North America, going to talk about trade policy and really the destruction that has happened since the passage of NAFTA, all of the manufacturing that we've lost in this country, all of the real wealth of the middle class. As we've been talking about, what you've seen is you have seen a massive redistribution of wealth from those of us who created it and worked hard for it up to those folks who, well, spent a lot of time sitting on yachts sipping margaritas. And I'm not saying that that's not hard work. I couldn't do it. But I don't think it's the same as going underground and digging in a coal mine. I don't think it's the same as swinging a sledgehammer or building a house or doing any of those jobs that create things. Remember, the only way this country is going to prosper and move forward is that if we actually produce product, if we actually produce something. Also in the second hour, Andre Gaines, one of the folks down in Mississippi. This is the one year anniversary of the Deep Horizon well explosion, and the massive spill that came after it. Andre is one of the guys who, in Mississippi spent a lot of time cleaning things up and in fact was hospitalized, for some time with vomiting and difficulty breathing from the chemical reaction and from the spilled oil. It'll be interesting to get his take on what's going on down there, how the process is coming along, where we need to go and, you know, what we have done. Also in the third hour, Joshua Holland from Alternet's going to be here talking about taxes. Great author, and they do a great job over at Alternet pointing out reality, something that I don't think most of the mainstream corporate-controlled media bothers with. It's all about infotainment. But those are the things we're going to talk about today. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So for all of you 420ers out there, happy pot day, everyone. Today at the Capitol, there was a rally to legalize marijuana, or at least, I guess, to decriminalize it. Personally, I think I would have held a munch-in. Maybe had it sponsored by somebody like Doritos or Twinkies or something like that. And get Big Pharma to bankroll the whole thing. Because I still doubt you're going to see the leafy green stuff. I doubt you're going to see Mary Jane on the shelf anytime soon. You're not going to see that leafy green stuff. But I do think we are going to find her sister on the shelf. Her sister, Savitex, which is a liquefied version of marijuana. And it could be on your local pharmacy shelves. quite soon, at a price, of course, because it is now being one of the things that Big Pharma is pushing to get the FDA to recognize the cannabis-derived drug and allow them to sell and market it and, of course, profit from it. And amazingly, you know, we have that drug bill, that prescription Part D plan that says we can't negotiate for price. Interesting stuff. You look at recently in Britain, they have a manufacturer, GW Pharmaceuticals, who recently announced an agreement with the Australia drug giant, Norvitus. They're the people who bring you Ritalin and Excedrin. So when you got a headache or hyper kids, Norvitus is the company you want to thank. They're going to begin selling this Sativex across Asia, across Africa, Oceania, and, of course, the Middle East. It's already available in Britain for people who suffer from multiple sclerosis and cancer. So I love this. The irony is just one of those things. This liquefied marijuana is produced and marketed by Bayer. You know, the people who brought you the children's aspirin? Yes, so same folks. It's also available in Canada and Spain as well. So just a couple of quick squirts under the tongue, and you are as high as a kite. So what's interesting to me is we've been seeing a lot of crackdowns by the feds on medical marijuana across the country. And, you know, you read stories like, you know, they've got this liquefied stuff. Big Pharma is pushing. You know, I'm not all that conspiratorial, but it just seems awfully coincidental that we're going after granny, we're going after people who are, you know, who are suffering from cancer or terminal illnesses right now. We're basically going to throw granny in jail for some cheap relief in favor of big profits. And this is one of those things, folks, that, as I've always said, once they can figure out how to profit from it, it's going to be legalized, much like solar panels. Once they figure out how to put them on your house and actually profit from it, they're going to be everywhere. So look out for that. Evidently, the big explosion that they had, the big spill, I shouldn't say explosion, that's a bit dramatic. There was a big fracking spill. They just call it a fluid leak. But they're saying a whole bunch of this stuff, thousands of gallons of this salt-laden frack fluid has spilled out up in Bradford County. They now say it's under control. Granted, the leak was 20 hours long, but it's under control. And it was happening during a well completion activity, which I love. I love that. They said they found it, and they're happy that it was just the fluid and it wasn't the gas. It's under control, and it spilled into the water, where it's probably going to get to the fish. And if it gets to where the trout are, they say, it'll probably kill all the trout. So don't worry about that. For me, I want to find these folks, and I want to get them to tell me now how they feel about the natural gas drilling in their backyard. Because if you look at the picture that WITF has at their website of the site, these people's backyards are like 25 feet from where the compound is. And, you know, you know they've all got well water. You know this probably got into the wells. So I want to try and get somebody to send me a gallon of their well water now, because I think it'll be something we can put on a shelf and look at and say, this is what frack water looks like. And maybe we could even label it and sell it off. A good entrepreneur could figure out how to sell polluted water from Pennsylvania across the country. Because if you remember after the big spill a year ago, there were actually people selling oil water that was coming in through their wells. So maybe we've got some good entrepreneurs here in Pennsylvania who will pick up on this. Because after all, we've sold out to the big drillers. We've got a governor who is going to do everything he can possibly do to make sure that they're enriched. We've got a governor who refuses to even consider taxing them like, oh, I don't know, every other state in the country, even the one that he idolizes. He wants to make Pennsylvania like Texas. They've got a 7.5% drilling tax. And a whole bunch of other things that tax the natural gas. But we won't even talk about those. Just a pure 7.5% would make me happy to start with. But we got a governor, not at all. And now, evidently, we've got a congressman and a bunch of them who think that it's a good idea. In fact, this GT, Glenn Thompson, GT, you got to love that, GT. He favors exporting the Marcellus shale natural gas to places like China. And we should export it to places where we don't have any trade agreements with. Go ahead, we're just going to get rid of it. And I got to be honest, you know, I go back and I read all the rhetoric because, you know, this is going to make us energy independent. It's going to get us off the juice. It's going to be that transfer energy that's going to make us energy independent. We won't have to worry about that big sandbox in the Middle East anymore. It's going to help us. And I'm going, now you look at the reality and you got these Republicans who can't help themselves. They really can't. And GT's one of them who just can't help himself but say, wow, we could sell all this stuff overseas and make profit. So we could profit from it and make sure that the U.S. is still hooked on oil so that we could profit again. Doesn't that sound great? Aren't you in favor of just shipping it out? Because remember, we were told it was going to benefit us. It's going to change our economy. It was going to change Pennsylvania forever. What I'm hearing, same old, same old. We're going to take a product that we were going to benefit from and somehow get none of the benefit. Does that sound right to you? The fact that this guy wants to, and then 15 other members of Congress who have written a letter to Obama saying, we want you to export somewhere around 16 million metric tons of this stuff a year to places, you know, all around the world, through Louisiana, through this Sabian Pass. To China, yeah, let's get it over there because there's profit to be made. I mean, we're already doing some of that. But they want to put the pedal to the metal. They want to go full tilt boogie. And what I find interesting, and you got to wonder when GT had this conversion. Because according to the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, who bothered to look at his website the day before yesterday, points out that on the website, this is one of the press releases. It says, quote, situations like that in Egypt continue to underscore the need to cease America's reliance on foreign energy. Our prosperity as a nation is dependent upon access to sustainable, low-cost energy, and I will continue to push for a comprehensive energy plan that meets these demands, promotes American energy, and builds a foundation for long-term economic growth and security. In another release, he goes on to say, affordable energy is vital to our economy and national security. High energy costs, slow job growth, increase the costs to industry and of products, and squeezes household budgets. And now what we want to do, we want to take this gold mine, we want to take this energy boon, and we want to steal it from the people of Pennsylvania and sell it off in China for profit. And understand that these companies that we're talking about, they're not Pennsylvania companies. So really, the wealth isn't going to stay here anyway. And I look at places like Alaska. And again, you know, it's easy to beat up on K Sera Sera, the trademarked one. Evidently, I wonder if they're going to put a trademarked symbol right on her forehead. You know, just a good, or maybe on her backside. I don't know. Anyway, when she was governor for those couple of months there in 2007 before she decided to quit, she signed legislation that increased the state's severance tax from 22.5% to 25%. Understand, Texas got 7.5%. Alaska, 25%. Pennsylvania, no percent. Now, the good socialist state of Alaska, understand, has no personal income taxes. Pretty much the whole state runs on their extraction tax. Imagine how you could shut the T-twits up in this state if you go, you know what? We've got all this energy. We could easily do away with the state income tax and just have the drillers pay it. Anyway, here's the point. In 2008, each person that lived in Alaska received a check. They received their little oil check in the mail for $2,069 apiece. Palin said that it was proper to share the wealth
of Alaska's natural resources. Share the wealth. That sounds socialistic to me. When did she change? When? We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with Russ Baker.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. By 2015, 36,000 auto factory jobs will be added at the Detroit 3 automakers, boosting the current UAW membership of 102,000 active auto workers at Ford, GM, and Chrysler in the U.S. Those jobs are expected to be so-called Tier 2 new hires, meaning they'll get about half the pay of veteran UAW auto workers. The UAW is in talks this year on a new domestic auto contract. The union recently announced a membership increase from 35,191 in 2009 to 376,612 in 2010. That's way down from the historic high of 1.5 million members reached in 1979. But the UAW says it hopes to keep growing in 2011 and beyond with new organizing. As the UAW negotiates a new contract this year, the likely target company will be Ford, the most profitable of the Detroit Three, and the only automaker where UAW members still have the right to strike. UAW President Bob King has said he's looking to make sure that workers who gave big concessions to save the U.S. auto industry can now share in the upside that these auto companies are now enjoying. New Jersey's Republican governor is moving to take more money from public workers' paychecks, Jesse Russell reports.
The administration of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has introduced his proposal for requiring state employees to pay more toward health care costs. On average, the New Jersey workforce currently pays roughly 1% of health care premiums. But under Christie's proposal, by 2014, employees will be paying on average 30% of the contribution. The plan will be phased in over 3 years, with an increase to 10% this July, to 17% in January 2012, 23% in January 2013, and the full 30% by July 2014. Democrats also have a plan that would phase in greater health care contributions based on salaries. The proposal was introduced by State Senate President Stephen Sweeney and would be rolled out over 7 years. According to Sweeney's contribution scale, workers making over $100,000 per year would pay 30% by the seventh year, while those making less than $30,000 per year would pay 12%.
In Wisconsin, recall petitions have now been turned in for 3 of the 8 Republican state senators targeted for voting to gut collective bargaining for public workers. State Senator Luther Olson joins Senators Dan Kopanky and Randy Hopper on Wisconsin's recall list. Petitions to recall a 4th senator are expected to be turned in soon. Right-wingers are also trying to get recall actions against 8 of the Wisconsin Democratic senators who stalled the anti-union bill by going to Illinois. But so far, no recall petitions have been filed against any Democrats. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Remember last year, Bloomberg News reported that Wachovia, which was one of the country's biggest banks, had made a habit of helping move money from Mexican drug smugglers, basically laundering. Wells Fargo, who acquired Wachovia, you know, during the whole TARP thing, got a bunch of money and took over Wachovia, back in 2010 admitted that they had failed to monitor and report suspected money laundering, by narcotics traffickers, including the cash used to buy 4 planes that shipped a total of 22 tons of cocaine. The case was settled for about $110 million, and Wachovia paid another $50 million in fines, according to the story, for failing to properly monitor the transfer of, get this, $378.4 billion in currency exchanges in Mexico. The charges, the criminal charges, dismissed. You know, I look at this stuff and I go, why aren't these people in jail? Why do we never see the bigwigs in jail? Why the people who crashed our economy, why don't we see people in the Gray Bar Hotel? It's amazing stuff. Anyway, I've got Russ Baker on the line from whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com. There's a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Russ, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
You know, I look at this stuff and I go, you know, the bigwigs never seem to find themselves locked up. They just pay a little fine, go on their way. And I look at your story over at whowhatwhy.com talking about Egypt, and it turns out that they're in jail.
Well, isn't that amazing? I mean, look at this. The sons of President Mubarak are in jail. The prime minister, the speaker of the parliament. I mean, all these guys are in jail. It's astonishing. It's just it's breathtaking to see this. And Mubarak is ill. That's the only reason he himself is not in jail yet. And they're being interrogated by these corruption investigators. And I was just thinking, you know, here's the New York Times, and everybody's saying, isn't that great, just heartwarming that, you know, this kind of thing can happen? I'd say, hello, I mean, how about our country? I mean, why is it that nobody of any real note gets locked up other than a kind of a Bernie Madoff or somebody like that? It was an isolated case. They can never seem to get any of these big guys. And the reason, of course, Rick, and you know that, is because they run the whole system. And so when you run the system, you make sure that whatever you do is technically not illegal.
Yeah, I mean, you have your lobbyists run in and write you a loophole to get out of it.
Well, they've got the whole thing, you know, the courts, they type the law firms. I was thinking about, remember Dan Rather when he tried to sue CBS about their getting rid of him? He must have had a hell of a time because, you know, he went around trying to get a law firm, and they were all tied up already by his old employer.
Yep.
They had every law firm tied up, so they got the courts, they got the lawyers, and as you point out, the lobbyists, and then they write the laws, and then the court interprets as they did in the Citizens United case. And so it's very, very difficult. And, you know, people ask me, Rick, you know, what can we do about this? Well, the reason I started whowhatwhy.com and the reason we're putting so much effort into growing that, and we hope everybody will become regular visitors to the site, is because it's the secret to all this is to actually just figure out how things work and to study it very, very carefully. And the more we do that and the more we share the information with other people who maybe don't understand how things work, eventually it's going to be possible to get the upper hand, because as long as there is at least the pretense of some kind of democracy in this country, those few people who stack the deck, who tilt the playing field, their greatest fear is information. Their greatest fear is that enough people will actually really understand how things work and begin to care.
Well, let me ask you this, Russ, because, you know, one of my big pet peeves. We're looking around the country. We're looking at the governors in Wisconsin and Ohio, here in Pennsylvania, Michigan. A lot of these right-wing governors are taking the chainsaw to education budgets, and I say one of the reasons they're doing it is to deny the next generation even the most minimal critical thinking skills so that they're unable to put two and two together, as you have done over at whowhatwhy.com, so that nobody has the ability to fight back.
Well, that's dead on, Rick. You know, the thing is that I was reading something very interesting the other day about the universities and what's going on there. You know, it's very interesting because they always talk, you know, Obama and his speeches and so on. They always talk about, you know, every American to be able to get a college education. And what do they mean by a college education? There was a time when the notion of going to college was related to being able, as you said, to have critical reasoning skills, to be able to think for yourself. And, of course, the more you can do that, the more your life changes, because the more choices you see, the more you're able to make wise decisions and so forth. But they really don't want that. What they want to do is they want to turn out an army of people with skills that make them good employees, which is an entirely different thing. And so what you see, I live in New York City. I go out and I sit somewhere and I overhear people talking and hear all these you know, very, so, you know, well-educated people from these Ivy League schools and what have you, and, but they're not talking about ideas. I don't hear them talking about what's happening in Wisconsin. I don't hear them talking about what's happening to the ordinary American, what's happening to the gutting of labor or teachers or anything. They're not talking about any of those things. They're completely wrapped up in, you know, their sort of their corporate careers, and talking about minutia, talking about, entertainment. And so, so education itself needs to be reexamined. And we need to think about why it is that they're not willing to take risks in education itself. I can tell you that, I mean, it'll be interesting because later this year I'll be going out on the lecture circuit. And it'll be interesting to see which, universities will and will not let me bring, this kind of message, not just the message from Who, What, Why, but as you know, when I was last on the show, we talked about my book,
right,
Family of Secrets, which is a sort of a hidden history of the United States, the real story behind the rise of the Bush family, the connections between major traumatic events like Watergate, the Kennedy assassination, and many other things. The whole history of this country that you know, when people read my book, professors, other journalists, they say, wow, this is amazing. I had no idea of any of these things, and you've documented so well. And then they say, gee, I sure wish I could help you. I sure wish I could get you on my TV show. I sure wish you could come and talk to my class. But they're afraid, Rick. They are actually afraid of risking, you know, this has been going on in this country since 9/11, this sense of terror that people are afraid to risk dissenting.
Well, I think part of it, the big part of it, is that the big money people, we have seen such a mass consolidation of media. We have seen a destruction of education. We have seen all of these attacks by the moneyed elite that nobody wants to lose that funding. Nobody, especially in this economy, people don't want to lose their jobs. It's really, to me, a product of all of this mass consolidation and the message being held by so few voices.
Well, that's right. And I mean, even in journalism, as you point out, not just the consolidation. So a handful of very, very wealthy entities and individuals control the information dissemination machine. And then you've got people trying to get out of that and starting these nonprofit news sites, which is whowhatwhy.com. Our site is a nonprofit. But if you look at them, almost all of those newer nonprofit sites got their funding from one or two or three extremely wealthy people, in several cases actually billionaires. You know, those people may be exceptions. They may be totally open to letting anything come out. But the fact that you, again, have to go to those kinds of interests always to get the approval to get information out to ordinary people, that right there tells you exactly what the problem is.
Yeah, I got a serious problem. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Russ Baker, whowhatwhy.com. We got a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Russ's name. It'll take you right there. And going back to what we were talking about in Egypt, you know, why don't we as a society demand what those folks demanded? I read your piece and one of the things, you know, this said that, you know, the thieves are inside prison now and the honest people are free. Why don't we look at things that way? That, you know, people like George W. Bush, I got to be honest, the more I'm reading, the more I'm finding out through the WikiLeaks stuff and some of the Freedom of Information stuff, this war in Iraq, it was about oil. I mean, we knew it all along, but now we're getting the documentation, and I don't think he's ever going to have to account for that.
Well, you know something, I mean, there's new information. I'll be putting something up on our site. But more information again about basically the allies making deals on oil, in Iraq before they agreed to go in there. And as you may know, in my book, Family of Secrets, I actually interviewed, George Bush's, ghostwriter, a guy who was working with Bush on a book. Mickey Herskowitz, back in 1999. And Bush's personal reason, he told Herskowitz back then, in 1999, years before they invaded Iraq, he already says to Mickey, Mickey says, what are you going to do if you're president? He says, well, I'll tell you one thing I'd like to do. I'd like to invade Iraq. And now, in Bush's own mind, his reason actually wasn't the oil, although obviously he knew because he was backed by big oil money. He came out of the oil business himself, his father as well. But in his own mind, that was a given, of course, to grab the oil. But he was actually thinking, boy, you know, if I can have a war and I can win a war, my ratings are going to go up. Now that itself, of course, should be grounds for serious prosecution. As yep. Vincent Bugliosi said, you know, prosecution for murder, because you're talking about how many lives lost to satisfy that particular whim. So, I mean, why can we not call these people crooks? Well, again, it goes back to the tepidness of the media. And by the way, another story I'd like to just kind of pull in here, which we've just, done a piece on our website, whowhatwhy.com. And that is about, did you hear about this guy, Greg Mortensen, wrote that book, Three Cups of Tea?
Yes.
About all these schools that he was starting in Afghanistan, and then 60 Minutes went out there and found that many of the schools didn't exist. The ones that did exist sometimes weren't functioning. The ones that were functioning said they didn't get much or any money from him. I mean, this guy fabricated this stuff and then sold 4 million books. He got on every major TV show. Why? Because what the media does is it sells people happy talk. It sells them heartwarming stories that make people feel better. And it kind of what the insidious side of that is, what it does is it makes people feel, you know, hey, what a heartwarming story about what this guy's doing. You know, I don't have to do anything myself because other people are doing the good things. And, of course, they're not really doing the good things. Now, what struck me was, here's this guy. So I thought, well, how does he get a platform for himself? And I went back and I looked at the New York Times, a guy named Thomas Friedman. You know, he's their lead sort of foreign affairs columnist, and he's a best-selling author, and he's on all those big TV shows. He wrote this piece, and he said, you know, sometimes I think, why are we in Afghanistan? It's expensive. We're losing all these lives. Why are we there? And they said, and then I see what this guy is doing with Three Cups of Tea and all these wonderful schools, and he says, and that's why we're still there. And you know, so it's this intermingling of this propaganda, the incompetence, the unwillingness to do due diligence, to be tough on these guys. It's so bad on so many different levels. And we need a kind of a revolution in this country, but just start, let's say, with a revolution of awareness.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I thought we were in Afghanistan to kill bin Laden and break up al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Right, and so even Friedman said, hey, I mean, mission accomplished, so I really have trouble understanding why we're still here, but hey, you know, this guy's building these schools and educating women, and yeah, all right, so let's go on. And it's very interesting because he actually is there. He gets flown in by, you know, the general, the American general, and it's so clearly a part of a propaganda effort, and of course what they're not talking about are things like the desire to use Afghanistan to run natural gas pipelines through there. I mean, you know, Rick, every
place. Don't forget the minerals.
Don't forget the minerals. That's right. Every place is the same bloody thing. By the way, Libya, you know, here we go again. You know, these rebels in Libya, whoever they are, and the general running them, you know where he's been living the last few years? He's been living in Virginia, just down the road from CIA headquarters.
Not a graduate of the School of Americas, I hope.
I hope not. But you know, this guy is there. He's their boy. But of course, all of these poor Libyans who are being encouraged to rise up are getting slaughtered because it's an unfair fight. They don't have the capacity to battle Gaddafi. And so ultimately, with the U.S. taking sides in this thing, but not really helping these people out enough, it puts them in an untenable position. Eventually, they're going to have to step up and start sending in troops again. And so then you say, well, why are they even there? You turn on your TV and you watch CNN and all this stuff, and they're not discussing at all why we're even there. Why is Gaddafi particularly any kind of a threat? And of course, again, you find the same story. Do you know that a couple of years ago, Gaddafi started pressing American and other oil companies to pay him large fees if they wanted to operate in his country, and these oil companies got very, very upset about that. Now, how much does that have to do with the real reason that we're in that country?
It has nothing to do with it. Nothing at all. Nothing. Nothing. Nothing, Russ. You're making things up.
Okay.
You're way off base.
I guess.
Because we're protecting our interests. We're protecting our interests.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, People say, geez, but Russ, this is so disheartening. What can we do? I mean, we can't do anything about it. And I say, you know something? Everything good in the world has been done by one person. You know, I mean, you look at a guy like Gaddafi, you talk about bad things. I mean, the only reason he's in power, he's one guy. Same thing with Mubarak. As soon as that person's, that individual's power is corroded, everything changes. Because everybody else in those countries live in fear. I covered the overthrow of Nicolae Ceaușescu in Romania many years ago. And, you know, this guy, these dictators were there for 30 years, 40 years, the entire country in fear of one person. And if you think about that, and then you think about the other side of the coin and what individuals have been able to achieve, look at our heroes in this country, Steve Jobs and, you know, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and whatever, and people who created cures and invented all kinds of things and inspired people. It was always one person, you know. And so if more people in our country started saying, like, you know, I bet I could do something. I'm just going to start by spending 10 minutes a day online finding important articles that people don't know about and just forwarding them, sending them to people, my relatives, my friends, people I've just met who don't know this stuff. I mean, we could start taking this country back much, much easier than people realize.
Yep, and that's the organizing that has to happen. It's what we saw in Wisconsin and what's going to have to happen across the country. The website, whowhatwhy.com. Russ Baker is the guy who runs that over there. Great site. Russ, I appreciate the time. Great work you guys do over there, and I hope to have you back again soon.
Anytime. Thanks.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
House Speaker John Boehner, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and Budget Chairman Paul Ryan like to portray themselves as the three budgeteers. Decrying deficits, the GOP's sharp-eyed slashers of federal spending are galloping through Congress with swords flashing, severing billions, nay, trillions, from the national budget. Medicare for seniors, behead it. Food stamps for the poor, whack 'em. Environmental protections, eviscerate 'em. Consumer agency, kill it. Practically all of the slash and burn rampage by the three budgeteers comes at the expense of America's middle class and the poor. For corporate powers and the wealthy elites, however, the dynamic trio offers more governmental gimmies, including a one-third cut in their tax rates. The budgeteers are also demanding that government workers take cutbacks. But wait, aren't Boehner, Cantor, and Ryan workers too? Well, yes, but very special workers. So when they recently took our government to the brink of a total shutdown, guess who they rushed to protect? Not emergency responders, toxic waste cleanup crews, air traffic controllers, or millions of other federal employees we count on, but themselves. In the Senate, Barbara Boxer had passed a bill to suspend the paychecks of all Congress critters if the government shuts down. But the three budgeteers blocked it in the House, thus protecting the $174,000 a year that each lawmaker sucks from us taxpayers. But then, the GOP threesome cynically tried to trick the public about their perfidy. They made a show of approving a House version of the congressional pay suspension, but tucked it into a bill with zero chance of passing. This is Jim Hightower saying, Boehner, Cantor, Ryan, remember those names. They think they're clever, and they are hoping that you are stupid.
To get more of Jim Hightower's popular take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Thank you, Donald. We got to thank the Donald. Evidently, now the Palin-Bachman twins are now split. Turns out Bachman was on with George Stephanopoulos this morning. And my Michelle, she has laid to rest the birther thing. It's all over. Once and for all, it's been settled. President Obama's birth certificate for the very first time ever was displayed to Michelle, and to wit, she is acting surprised. Oh, my goodness, that must be it. So now we can put it to rest, move on, create jobs. On the other hand, the trademarked one, que sera, sera, she's doubling down. She's kind of a gambler on this. She's doubling down on the birther thing, claiming that the Donald is being treated unfairly by the mainstream corporate-controlled media. He's being treated so unfairly. Even though right there in Stephanopoulos' hands, there it is with the raised seal and all that stuff on it. She's still gonna back him. So good for her. The trademarked one, not doing so well in her home state. Evidently, a new Alaska poll was released today showing 61% of people who live in Alaska have a very unfavorable opinion of the trademarked one, the quitter governor, and the former 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee. So look, she quit as governor. She tanked a presidential campaign. I mean, what's not to love about her? From my perspective, I think she's the best thing out there. She's the gift. She's like herpes, the gift that keeps on giving. So I hope she stays out there. She's not going to run, but I hope she stays out there because she's just funny. Plain funny. Anyway, another one of these evangelical Lulus are out there, and he's made kind of a name for himself, claiming that equal access to the Internet, having that net neutrality, that's against the Bible. It's against the teachings of the Bible. We can't have equal anything. In fact, the founding fathers, they'd have been against net neutrality. This guy, David Barton, one of these evangelical activists, he has a radio program, and he said that, that net neutrality thing, it's violating the biblical principle. That biblical principle of free markets, a principle upheld by the Benjamin Franklin himself, by the Thomas of Jefferson, and by the George of Washington. And I'm trying to figure out exactly what the Bible, and especially Jefferson, have to do with each other. I guess Washington, too, because when Washington was dying, as the story goes, he didn't call for a priest or a minister or anybody to administer last rites. He actually asked for a watch so he could time his heartbeats to see when he was going. So, again, this whole thing going. But our good friend David Barton, he was a bloviating. He was a telling the good word. He's saying that this is part of the reason we have prosperity. This is what the pilgrims brought in. This is what the Puritans brought to us. This free market mentality. Net neutrality sounds real good, but it is socialism on the internets. He's sounding kind of crazy, doesn't he? He goes on to say, this is really, and I'm going to use the word. I'm going to use it. I'm going to use the word wicked stuff. And I don't use that word very often. But this, my friends, this is wicked, wicked stuff. And I look at this guy, and he's just another one of these right-wing nutcases. Co-chair of the Texas Republican Party. Founder of Wall Builders. They're one of these bizarre groups who like to talk about America's forgotten history. Whatever the heck that means. I guess that's whatever they can make up at the time. And the cherry on the top of the crazy train, he is a lecturer at the prestigious and long-term, the place that's just churned out so many scholars and Nobel Prize laureates and large brains. He lectures at the Glenn Beck University. I can't make that up. I wish I could. Anyway, as Talking Points memo points out, Barton appeared as one of the witnesses for the Texas Board of Education with their textbook hearings, and he argued that homosexuality should be regulated by the government. It's kind of weird, that whole free market argument, that whole liberty thing kind of going and then saying, I don't know. But he went on to in his sermon on net neutrality by saying that this is the fairness doctrine applied to the internets. And I'll go back to what I believed for a long time. Fair is a word no Christian should ever use in their vocabulary. Fair has nothing to do with anything. If you want what you want is justice, you don't want fairness. Again, he goes back and says that the internets, this is redistribution of wealth through the internets. And it really is. It's really redistribution. This is socialism on the internets.
I mean, I can't. You can't make this up, Jake.
I'm sure you can't.
Maybe you don't find it as funny as I do.
No,
I think it's hysterical.
It's kind of sad if you really believe that.
But again, you know, it shows all of these really outward evangelical people who have followers, and that's what scares me. That there are people who actually listen to that and actually give him money. That's the really scary part of it. And then, you know, you look at in Michigan right now as if Michigan doesn't have enough trouble. You got this cuckoo guy who, you know, burnt the Koran and ended up causing a bunch of people to be killed over in Afghanistan. This Terry Jones, remember the guy who for a long time they had the whole thing going up to 9/11 and he finally backed down. Well, he burnt it not too long ago. Well, now he's planning on... having this rally in Michigan, in Dearborn, Michigan, at one of the large mosques there. And he's saying it's Stand Up America Now. And they're going to have their little shindig there. And they're encouraging people, from what I understand. He said, we will be armed. We do have concealed weapons permits. Again, you know, kind of crazy. And this is in the name of religion to be talking about the internet and to be talking about, you know, going to the protest with a gun in your pocket. Scary stuff. Scary, scary stuff. Anyway, last thing before we go and take a break. Tom DeLay's former assistant, Michael Scanlon, he's now serving time in federal prison for his role in the Abramoff scandal. Good for him. He was sentenced to 20 months. In prison for defrauding Indian tribes and bribing government officials, including his boss. He went to jail as well. He's now dancing behind the bars. Anyway, going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You know, I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You work so hard. Say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just applied for workers' comp and you'll get paid for lost time and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I give my head to the music.
Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Tomorrow at noon, we're going to be up in Pottsville at the Pottsville Club, 201 South 22nd Street, 26th Street, sorry. The United Labor Council of Schuylkill County is going to have an informational protest there at the Pottsville Club. So we're going to go up and talk to them and, you know, and talk about what it is that they're protesting and go from there. Also, next Thursday, April 28th, is Workers' Memorial Day. Workers across the country are going to take a little time to remember those workers who were injured or died on the job. There's going to be a number of actions across the state. Here in Harrisburg, they're having some things put on by the Pennsylvania Federation of Injured Workers. 8 a.m., they're going to have a breakfast. 9:30, I believe, there's going to be a memorial down at Laborers Grove down on Front Street. And at 11 o'clock, there's going to be a rally at the Capitol. So we encourage folks to come out and participate because, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. If we allow the things that have been going on to continue to go on, don't be surprised if it happens to you and there's no one there to help you. Also, tomorrow night the Carlisle School Board is having their meeting 7 o'clock. So there you go. Earlier in the program, you know, right before we talked to Russ Baker, we were talking about Wachovia and how Wells Fargo took them over. And you know, Wachovia had been doing some things like, drug trafficking. Or not drug trafficking, money laundering of drug money. And the number just really, $378.4 billion in currency exchanges in Mexico. That's money that's just being laundered through our system, being sent back to Mexico. They paid $110 million fine, and Wachovia paid $50 million fine. You're talking about $378 billion. Billion with a B. Nobody went to jail. This, without question, is the biggest money laundering scandal of our time. And I got to be honest, I would argue ever. And nobody's going to jail. That's the part that bothers me. The big fish never seem to go to jail. It's the guy who steals a candy bar from the local corner store. He's the guy who does hard time in Folsom or San Quentin. But these big white collar criminals, nothing at all, Jake. And it's one of these things that, you know, I look at the whole collapse of our economy. Nobody. We got a couple of minor players. Madoff was a nobody. But they made him out to be the man. We got him. We got the guy who crashed the economy, and we're going to put him away.
First of all, two comments. Comment and a question. You know, Bernie keeps saying that none of his family knew anything. Well, I refuse to believe that, but that's another story. Maybe eventually the truth will come out.
I believe it.
Are you telling me that there's no federal investigation into this case?
Is that it's done. It's all done.
It's done.
It is done. Charges were dismissed. They paid the fine. They moved on. Charges dismissed. All gone. Over.
So all they got was a fine.
That's it. That's all they ever get. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this is there was actually a guy. His name's Martin Wood. He was one of Wachovia's senior anti-money laundering officers. It was his job to oversee this stuff. And he did. He blew the whistle. He said, hey, this is going on. He's part of the reason the whole investigation happened. He's out on his butt. You know, they gave him an amount of money that he can't say, and they've settled with him, and he can say nothing. They've tied him up in legalese. He can say nothing. And they're secure, man. They cover themselves. These criminals cover themselves.
Well, it's ironic they talk today on TV about BP and the BP spill. Well, this is kind of the anniversary. There you have a situation where BP made a conscious decision to save a little money. In fact, the company that they had subcontracted to run that project decided that they wanted to be safe, spend a little more money. They were overruled. They were overruled by the Home Office in London. The CEO is involved in that decision. They consciously made that decision to save a little money, and what happened? I believe it was 11 people on that rig died. They no one knows the total cost. They've pretty much destroyed an industry which was a focal point of the economy down there, the fishing industry. No one knows the total cost yet. And where was the penalty? This man basically got booted out as CEO. And you know what his penalty is, Rick? For the rest of his life, he has to accept every year, the poor guy, a retirement of over $900,000. But the key is, every year until he dies, $900,000. That man should be in jail. He's a criminal.
He's going to have to watch his boat sail.
Oh, ain't it tough?
In the regatta.
I mean, let's set him a card saying how sorry we are. But seriously, who's paying for the deaths of those men? Who's paying for what could amount to the death? Could amount to the death of an industry which is key and vital to that part of the country? Who's going to answer for all that damage? We're talking long-term, probably hundreds of billions of dollars. And who's going to answer for it?
You know, I always go back to George Carlin, and I love George Carlin.
American value that's left, buying things. People spending money they don't have on things they don't need. Money they don't have on things they don't need so they can max out their credit cards and spend the rest of their lives paying 18% interest on something that costs $12.50. And they didn't like it when they got it home anyway.
I love George. That wasn't the clip. This one was.
They want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly easier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club.
No, that sure is true, and I miss
Boy,
that guy.
Was that so right on?
I mean, every word of it. You go back and you look at this whole collapse of our economy. Nobody has been held to account. And, you know, I say it should start right at the top. And look, you know, there's nobody who's immune from this. You know, I'd start with Greenspan. Start with the Fed. And work your way down from there. And clean out all of them. And break up this big money system. I mean, you know, at some point, we're going to have to organize and take to the streets. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with Norman Caulfield. He's the author of NAFTA and Labor in North America. Back after this.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. By 2015, 36,000 auto factory jobs will be added at the Detroit 3 automakers, boosting the current UAW membership of 102,000 active auto workers at Ford, GM, and Chrysler in the U.S. Those jobs are expected to be so-called Tier 2 new hires, meaning they'll get about half the pay of veteran UAW auto workers. The UAW is in talks this year on a new domestic auto contract. The union recently announced a membership increase from 35,191 in 2009 to 376,612 in 2010. That's way down from the historic high of 1.5 million members reached in 1979. but the UAW says it hopes to keep growing in 2011 and beyond with new organizing. As the UAW negotiates a new contract this year, the likely target company will be Ford, the most profitable of the Detroit Three, and the only automaker where UAW members still have the right to strike. UAW President Bob King has said he's looking to make sure that workers who gave big concessions to save the U.S. auto industry can now share in the upside that these auto companies are now enjoying. New Jersey's Republican governor is moving to take more money from public workers' paychecks, Jesse Russell reports.
The administration of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has introduced his proposal for requiring state employees to pay more toward health care costs. On average, the New Jersey workforce currently pays roughly 8% of health care premiums. But under Christie's proposal, by 2014, employees will be paying on average 30% of the contribution. The plan will be phased in over 3 years, with an increase to 10% this July, to 17% in January 2012, 23% in January 2013, and the full 30% by July 2014. Democrats also have a plan that would phase in greater health care contributions based on salaries. The proposal was introduced by State Senate President Stephen Sweeney and would be rolled out over 7 years. According to Sweeney's contribution scale, workers making over $100,000 per year would pay 30% by the 7th year, while those making less than $30,000 per year would pay 12%.
In Wisconsin, recall petitions have now been turned in for 3 of the 8 Republican state senators targeted for voting to gut collective bargaining for public workers. State Senator Luther Olson joins Senators Dan Kopanky and Randy Hopper on Wisconsin's recall list. Petitions to recall a 4th senator are expected to be turned in soon. Right-wingers are also trying to get recall elections against 8 of the Wisconsin Democratic senators who stalled the anti-union bill by going to Illinois. But so far, no recall petitions have been filed against any Democrats. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Where did you find that music? Wow. I guess it was the only thing that had NAFTA in it. And, you know, and I guess, you know, the reality is maybe we're not singing enough about how bad NAFTA has been, or at least from my perspective. That's why I've asked Dr. Norman Caulfield, professor of history at Fort Hays State University, and also the author of NAFTA and Labor in North America. Dr. Caulfield, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, I look at, you know, in Washington, all I keep hearing we need to cut spending. We've got these massive deficits. To me, I think the first thing we should be talking about are our massive trade deficits, which I say were brought on by trade deals like NAFTA.
Well, that's absolutely correct, because when you have huge trade deficits, that shaves off points of your gross domestic product. And if your economy doesn't grow, then, of course, you don't get jobs. And so, you know, you look back at NAFTA, you look at bringing China into the WTO and so forth, and you can see that, you know, these trade deficits have a negative impact on economic growth, number one, and secondly, jobs. And in the process, many jobs are outsourced. And, of course, when jobs are outsourced, that means that jobs are lost in other countries, and it's just a race-to-the-bottom situation.
Yeah, for the past couple of days, we've been talking about how, you know, the big multinationals like GE and Caterpillar have been offshoring jobs at an alarming pace, because basically we're saying, you know, here, go ahead, you can send your products back freely, and here's some money to go out the door with you, basically rewarding them for doing the insane things that we're basically sanctioning, and then we're surprised that our economy's struggling.
Yeah, that's something that's been going on for quite some time. You know, talking a little bit about NAFTA and how it came about, you know, we go back to the 70s, and really when the dollar is allowed to float against other currencies. Richard Nixon does that in 1971. That's a big signal. That's the same year that he, in fact, goes over to China and meets with Mao. And then, of course, Deng Xiaoping comes back over here later on and gets up on a stage and dances around with a cowboy hat on. And away comes China. They're open. And Mexico, when they got into NAFTA in 1994, they didn't really think China was a factor or going to be. It wasn't at the time, but by the year 2000, China certainly was. And, yeah, you're right, Rick. These trade deficits have ballooned. And in the process, of course, our economies don't grow like the proponents of these free trade agreements said they would grow. And we lose jobs, not only the offshoring, but we lose jobs in sectors where it's, you know, you're not talking about something that's really vulnerable to offshoring. You get downsizing. A lot of people don't understand, too, that it's just not about exporting manufacturing. It's capital flows. It's exporting capital. Capital has been globalized in all this.
Right.
And, you know, businesses that need capital, they have to apply for loans, and then, you know, the bank tells them, well, you know, we don't like your balance sheet. You're paying too much labor cost. As we see, you've got a union here. Why don't you ask them for concessions? You know, bust them down a little bit. Walmart does that with their suppliers. They say, hey, you're in a high rent district. You know, why don't you move out of there? So, you know, a lot of people look at just manufacturing and what can be outsourced, but they tend to forget that capital is now global too.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about on the program often is that most of these trade deals, the first thing they do negotiate are breaking down borders for capital. People can't cross borders, but money can.
Absolutely.
And the example I always use is Argentina after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, where basically their entire economy collapsed because all the money pulled out. And there were no controls there to slow that down at all. Which is, I think, what the investor class wants globally. They want to be able to have major booms and busts and that benefit them.
Well, you know, I think back to Monday of this week and the S&P outlook in terms of U.S. debt turning their outlook negative. And, of course, you know, this is what they did all over Europe last year. And, of course, they're putting pressure on both political parties to come to some sort of agreement which will slash the deficit. And, of course, who makes out? You know, the bondholders and the investors.
Yeah, the very wealthy.
They say that we want a safe environment to invest in, you know, and we can't have the government spending money on people who are old and sick, and we can't stand for workers' protections because that has nothing to do with making money.
And I think they want, you know, again, you know, it's quite clear they want us to level off with the Chinese and the Mexicans to where we're making pennies on the dollar. And we have a two-class system, those who have and those, well, who don't.
Well, in my book, I discuss this quite a bit. And, yes, you know, this has been a trend, but the crisis that developed about 3.5 years ago has really given the upper crust in our society an opportunity to really escalate this race to the bottom. That is, you know, and people just, I don't think are really ready for it. You're starting to see some pushback a little bit, but I don't think the big pushback has come yet because they're still really pushing hard on the other side. I call it a one-sided class war.
Yeah, I mean, the working class is getting pummeled.
Well, exactly, and they have been for a while, but, you know, it hasn't been this noticeable in the past. And, you know, they've been chipping away and chipping away, and now they see an opportunity to really take a big step. You know,
I mean,
use this crisis as an excuse to strip rights away and drive wages and benefits down even further.
Yeah, you look at a new report that just came out by the AFL-CIO that in 2010, the average, you know, chief executive of Fortune 500 companies, 343 times what the typical American worker makes. 343 times. That means almost they work one day a year for what it takes you or me to work for an entire year.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing free trade agreements have done, and this is easily documented by numerous studies, they have produced more inequality, social inequality in all these countries. You know, I look at North America in my book. I look at Canada, Mexico, and the United States, and the trends are the same. Union membership is down. Strikes are down. Social inequality is up. And, you know, and a lot of that is traceable back to these free trade agreements. The other thing I want to say about free trade, because I know you want me to talk about this, Rick, is that there are all kinds of free trade agreements being done now.
Yep.
They're proliferating everywhere. The Obama administration wants to do one now with Colombia, where they murder trade unionists. It wants to do one with South Korea. But the European unions, they're doing their free trade agreements, excuse me, and so are other countries. And this is what was happening in the first part of the 20th century. And, you know, we already have history to show us that this doesn't work, that free trade agreements, if you get so many of them like this, one will outweigh the other or offset the other. And in the end, tariffs and reductions and duties and all this really don't mean much. And trade really stalls out. This is what happened in the first half of the 20th century. And after World War II, the United States, of course, was the top dog, the big superpower. We had the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, and the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. Well, all that begins to fall apart in the 70s, and they can never put anything back together because the world's changed. The world's more competitive. The United States is not as dominant economically as it once was. So that's really what's bringing about all these free trade agreements. You don't have any global rules anymore. And everybody wants to get an advantage, especially during a sharp economic downturn that we're experiencing now. Everybody wants to beggar thy neighbor with currency and trade wars. And so there's this rush for free trade agreements. But, you know, currency wars, let's cheapen our currency vis-a-vis another government. Well, you know what? In the United States, for example, it's tough for working people getting their wages cut to put food on a table and put gasoline in their vehicles, you know. And this is hurting working people. So it's just not trade. It's the currency policies
right
that countries are following, like the Federal Reserve. They're buying up all this U.S. debt, and they're cheapening the dollar. And they say, well, that's good for exports, that's good for companies. Yeah, what are these companies doing, Rick? They're exporting jobs.
Well, I mean, this whole election cycle this past November was all about being more business-friendly, and you brought up the Colombian Free Trade Agreement. What could be more business-friendly than allowing, you know, companies to throw unionists out of plants?
Well, yeah, they're just brutal down there, and now all of a sudden they have some sort of a friendly labor-friendly regime down there that's going to put this clause in the free trade agreement that's going to protect workers' rights.
Magically.
Well, you know, I worked in Washington, D.C. for the NAFTA Labor Side Agreement Office for 3 years. That office is now shut down. It's a virtual office, basically. That ought to tell you how committed the United States government is to workers' rights in North America. So if they're not committed to workers' rights in North America, how can they convince people that they're committed to workers' rights in South Korea, Colombia, Panama, and elsewhere?
Excellent point. Let me ask you this. You know, we know what the problems are. How do we fix them? Can you turn this ship around? Can you right it? Is there anything that we can do short of scrapping these agreements and starting over? Where do we go from here?
Well, I'm familiar with North America in particular. You know, I look at, okay, one of the reasons why they've really militarized the border between the U.S. and Mexico, in my view, is to make Mexican labor even cheaper in the long run, because it's going to be more difficult to penetrate that. Now, you're going to see changes in immigration in this country. Right now they're not dealing with it, but eventually they will. And what they're going to have, in my view anyway, is the proliferation of new guest worker programs. And I guess what I can say is that, you know, a good place to start to change all this is you got to have cross-border worker solidarity.
Yep.
You know, because the same corporations that are, you know, messing with Canadian workers and Mexican workers are also messing with American workers. They're everywhere. And their goal is to drive everybody's wages down as low as they can get them, and strip all protections that workers have. And, you know, heck, health insurance, who needs that, right? We'll give you a Band-Aid or an aspirin, you know. We can supply that for you at work. Oh, I mean, that's where all this is going, Rick.
Well, we're going back to the way it was in the 1890s, where, you know, you were disposable.
Oh, yeah, we're going back to the Gilded Age, no doubt about it.
I mean, I say quite frequently the Republicans want to repeal the entire 20th century.
Well, I don't think they're going to stop until they drive the working class into absolute poverty.
But the problem with that is, you know, again, we're supposed to be this great consumer-based economy. You know, we're the consumer of last resort for the globe. If you do that, if you drive everyone into poverty, who buys your products? How does the business stay afloat if no one can afford what you're hawking?
Well, you know, we can go back to Henry Ford in the early 20th century. You know, he vehemently opposed unions, but what did he say? He said, well, I'm going to pay them $5 a day, which was a lot of money back then, because these Model Ts that are rolling off my assembly lines, somebody's got to buy them. So, you know, along comes this concept called Fordism, which was based on mass production and mass consumption. Well, you know, we still have production. I don't know if it's mass production anymore because globalization has allowed breaking up production into these global supply chains. And you're absolutely right. Look at the auto industry as an example. You know, how much overcapacity or underconsumption, if you look at it from the other side, is there? Will the auto industry ever come back to where it once was globally? I really doubt it when you have most people in the world earning less than $2 or $1 a day. That's how much money they got to live on. And, you know, in the advanced industrial countries like the United States and Western Europe, things are getting more and more difficult. And I think your point is well taken. Who is going to pay for all these consumer durable goods and so forth? Obviously, I think... you know, that has a lot to do with where we're at. That is the economy contracting and not growing. And I think that's been that's not just been a problem in the last few years. That's been a problem for a while, especially since the recession of 2000, the dot-com bubble burst. And really, employment never came back very much, and either did wages or consumption. You know, not like it did before. So right. This is a long-term problem.
Absolutely. And then it's a problem of how can you be a first-world country if you can't produce anything? Again, the book is NAFTA and Labor in North America. We've got a link to our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Dr. Caulfield's name. It'll take you there so you can purchase it. Dr. Caulfield, I appreciate the information. Great book. I'd love to have you back again sometime.
Well, I'm glad to be on your show. And, you know, when these free trade agreements go up for debate in Congress, call me back, and I'd love to talk to you again.
Terrific. Thank you, Doctor.
All right. Goodbye.
We're going to take a quick break. Back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Where do we go from here? Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
House Speaker John Boehner, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and Budget Chairman Paul Ryan like to portray themselves as the three budgeteers. Decrying deficits, the GOP's sharp-eyed slashers of federal spending are galloping through Congress with swords flashing, severing billions, nay, trillions, from the national budget. Medicare for seniors, behead it. Food stamps for the poor, whack 'em. Environmental protections, eviscerate 'em. Consumer agency, kill it. Practically all of the slash-and-burn rampage by the three budgeteers comes at the expense of America's middle class and the poor. For corporate powers and the wealthy elites, however, the dynamic trio offers more governmental gimmies, including a one-third cut in their tax rates. The budgeteers are also demanding that government workers take cutbacks. But wait, aren't Boehner, Cantor, and Ryan workers too?
Well, yes, but very special workers. So when they recently took our government to the brink of a total shutdown, guess who they rushed to protect? Not emergency responders, toxic waste cleanup crews, air traffic controllers, or millions of other federal employees we count on, but themselves. In the Senate, Barbara Boxer had passed a bill to suspend the paychecks of all Congress critters if the government shuts down, but the three budgeteers blocked it in the House, thus protecting the $174,000 a year that each lawmaker sucks from us taxpayers. But then, the GOP threesome cynically tried to trick the public about their perfidy. They made a show of approving a House version of the congressional suspension, but tucked it into a bill with zero chance of passing. This is Jim Hightower saying, Boehner, Cantor, Ryan, remember those names. They think they're clever, and they are hoping that you are stupid.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Yeah, you know, and going on this trade thing, you got Obama, who, again, you know, you look at this trade stuff, and it's just, you know, how much can we give away? How much of our manufacturing base can we lose to really developing nations who allow their employees, their workers to be exploited, their environment to be degraded? How much of this can we do? And now the president evidently is going to be talking on April 28th, which, again, you know, it's Workers' Memorial Day. You're going to choose April 28th to talk to the president of Panama about the Panamanian free trade agreement. It's not bad enough we're talking about one with South Korea, then Colombia, where they throw trade unionists out of planes. Now we're talking about one with Panama, and this one's particularly dangerous, in my opinion, because this is a way that the money leaves. This is how the money ends up getting out of the country, because they're a little friendlier to capital and to the very, very wealthy. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Ike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Ike?
All right, brother. I don't know. It's tough to keep your head up and your chin up and all that and all the garbage going on this shock and all multi-point front, you know, war that they've got going on here. It's hard to keep up with everything.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, you were talking about Wachovia. That's something that's always amazed me is, you know, none of this money stuff goes on in this country without their fingers in it. Big banks and the brokerage houses and et cetera, they've got to move that money. Even dirty money's got to be moved.
Yeah, I looked at that, and, you know, you're looking at $378 billion. Billion with a B in illegal money that, you know, if you had somebody who was willing to say, you know what, they actually did have someone to say it's going on, but if you had someone who said, we need to stop that, you know how much money could have helped the economy? You seize that. You stop it.
No doubt. No doubt. We've got a real breakdown of the justice system here. There's no two ways about it. You know, the feds aren't doing their job, and, you know, I mean, all the way across the board, they're just not getting the job. They're just not doing their job. You know, there was something I was hoping you would ask that guy about the trade agreements, and I hear this argument all the time, but I seem to remember it a different way. If I'm not mistaken, there was a big fight with the Clinton administration over NAFTA. NAFTA originally, if I'm not mistaken, was negotiated under the auspices of George H.W. Bush.
It started under Reagan. It was negotiated under HW. It was almost done. They had the signing ceremony already set up, and then oops, HW loses the election.
That's right.
But during the election process, Clinton was a free trader all along as well. He had read Friedman's book, The Olive and the Lexus and the Olive Branch, or whatever it was, you know, the world's flat idea, and he bought into the free trade model, and he was going to sign it as well.
Well, yeah, but I do remember a fight went on over trying to get provisions in there for basic wage structures and unionization, et cetera, which is why, if I'm not mistaken, if you go back and look at the vote, all the Democrats in the House voted against it, and all the Republicans voted for it.
I don't think it was all. I think there were some Democrats that voted.
Yeah. But, I mean, that would also set up some of the friction for the government shutdown later on down the line. But you know, I guess in closing, I'll say, because I know you're coming up to the half hour, you know, something that always continues to bother me, and you know, we can talk about outsourcing, and we can talk about, you know, what's going on with labor in this country, but I think if we don't deal with the two main issues that I continue to see, which is, you know, this idea that you can bribe your way into a state and get them to give you all kinds of money to bring your company in there and play one state against the other, I think that should fall under the purview of interstate commerce.
And the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, right there with you.
I think the Fed should step in there and stop that. But beyond that, as long as we continue to ignore the wage disparity between North and South, which is where we're face it, man, the South's taking all y'all's jobs, every job they can get their hands on. That's how we got Seattle's operation, or a good chunk of Seattle's operation here, because it's non-union and low wage. But until we find a way to fix that, and also until we find a way to stop this flood from across the border of cheap and illegal, in some cases illegal labor, until we find a way to stop flooding the lower end of the labor market that continues to cheapen construction and manufacturing and a lot of other jobs, I'll tell you what, we're doomed. We're absolutely doomed. And you know, the further I go down this line, the more I said 15 years ago when I was considering it and actually had a small window of a chance of getting out here and going to Australia, I look back on that now and I'm wishing I would have done it, because this is insane what's going on here, buddy. And I guess I'll close it with my famous saying, what's it going to take, another Kent State? Because well, we should be in the streets already. We should have been in the streets 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you. Ike, I appreciate the call, brother.
All right, brother. Y'all have a good one.
Thanks so much. But, you know, you go back to the NAFTA thing. And, yeah, there were some provisions that were put in. I don't think they were near strong enough. They were, you know, toothless. But they did attempt to put some labor and environmental restrictions in there. And, you know, again, when you put that kind of stuff in there, it comes down to who's going to enforce it.
Clinton was opposed to the labor provisions in there, but he agreed to it. You know, the one thing, big difficulty that I have with Obama is that 2008 he campaigned on really trying to reform free trade, and you know, it appears that the influence of many of his advisors who come from Wall Street, from our perspective, has been the wrong advice. I mean, you look at those free trade agreements now, Panama, that's going to be another Cayman Islands. Colombia hasn't, they're just putting, you know, they're just dressing up the situation down there. They haven't brought people to justice down there still. It's still the wrong place to go for the wrong reason.
Business friendly. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the BP spill, and talk with Andre Gaines, one of the cleanup workers down in Mississippi. We're back after this.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make halfway halfway.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
So it was a year ago today. It was a year ago today that BP's Deepwater Horizon offshore rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 workers lost their lives. Got 17 people injured. And they still haven't done what they said they were going to do. It took them 85 days to cap the gusher. Estimated 5 million barrels of oil in the Gulf. And we find out that now they're still doing the same thing, the same as it was, same as it always was. A year after, they're still filling the campaign coffers of the Republican Party. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, they've given, you know, BP North America has given money to House Speaker John Boehner, House Energy Committee Chairman Fred Upton. They've also given money to the Republican House Committee and the Senatorial Committee. So the money's flowing. BP's PAC money flowing right as it always has. And amazingly, they have only found money going to one Democrat from BP, a guy from Indiana. To me, that really kind of tells you where we're going in this country. Business has decided that the Republicans are their folks. They're going to keep them safe. And look at the fact that nobody is going to prison over those 11 people dead. Nobody. That's what's frustrating to me, Jake. You know, we seem to think that workers are disposable. You can just, you know, that's 11 people. Never mind.
Well, you could say the same thing about the 29 miners dead down in West Virginia. Where's the justice?
You know, talking about miners, today, back in 1914, National Guardsmen opened up fire on mining camps, on this mining camp occupied by striking miners in Ludlow, Colorado. Today, 5 miners were killed, 2 women and 12 children. By the time the Ludlow strike ended, more than 75 people had been killed in what is called the Ludlow Massacre, because it's what it was. You had these so-called National Guardsmen, who were really nothing but a bunch of hired goons and thugs and vigilantes, hired by who? Who hired them? Oh, the people who own the Ludlow mine. You know, does the name John D. Rockefeller Jr. ring a bell? Yeah. He's the guy who hired these thugs. Of course, they were temporarily sworn in. You're deputized. You're part of the state militia. And what were they deputized for? What were they sworn in for? Well, they go down there and bust up those strikers. Put those workers in their place. And the National Guard opened up fire on the enemy. You know, those workers and their families, you know, the people who wanted to feed their kids. They opened up fire with machine guns, and they set their tent city on fire. Set it on fire. 10,000 miners, 1,200 of them were in that camp. And why were they striking? Same reason that, same things that are going on today, man. Greedy mine owners saying, push coal. You just remember what Don Blankenship said? If your foreman tells you to do anything but run coal, ignore him. Running coal pays the bills. Back then, they weren't paid for any of the dead work. You know, like making sure the roof's not going to collapse, making sure there's ventilation, making sure that that things are secure, the tunnels, all that stuff. And not to mention, they were living in company towns, being paid with script. And I remember a guy, when I first moved here to Pennsylvania, the guy was in his late 40s. He said when he got back, I guess he was probably a little older than that. He said when he got back from Vietnam, they gave him, he had a little pot of money that he had saved. And when he got back, he paid off his father's debt to the mine, to the company store. And that was the first time in the history of his family that they were not indebted to the company store, that they were not indebted to somebody.
I don't think the average Pennsylvanian knows the violent history, the massive amount of injustice in this state where the railroads owned the state politically. And when you come to work for them, you were in debt. You were in debt to the old song Tennessee Ernie Ford used to sing about the company store. And the stories are told of how when miners died, the company people would put them on carts, and they would take that cart down to the house that they lived, which was owned by the company, and they would throw that dead body on the and they would knock on the door and leave. That's all you got from the company, and they made you vacate that house. And that's the way people were treated, and you tell me the difference between that and slavery.
Well, there's a huge difference between that and slavery. Slavery, they actually have to take care of you. They own you, your property. They got to feed you. They got to make sure you're well. They got to make sure you're housed. There are actually some laws on the books to how you treat a slave. If you're a worker today, there are no laws.
I remember when I first got involved in the movement, and there was this, he was maybe 20 years older. I mean, he said he remembers his father telling stories about how when he had mine cave-ins, the first thing that the mine owner foreman were worried about, save the mules. That was actually more valuable to them than the life of a miner, because the miners could be replaced.
Absolutely.
Mules couldn't.
They were a dime a dozen. And you look at the story today in The Nation, a guy named Mike Ames and our friend Mike Elk have revealed that the folks over at Koch Industries mailed out letters to 50,000 employees, basically telling them how to vote in the 2020 election, and basically pushing a whole bunch of propaganda towards influencing their vote. And, you know, as I'm reading through this, I'm going, you know, this is what unions need to be doing. This is the kind of stuff that labor used to do, talking to their members, talking to their folks on the job. People like the Koch brothers have figured this out, that you've got them captive. Let's influence them, and not subtly either. Talking about, you know, that this is how you're going to lose your job if the wrong people get in. You know, we're going back to those days, the days of veiled threats. And what I find amazing is that we're not surprised when this stuff happens. And I go back and I look at all of the, I think about some of the things, some of the places that I've worked over the years. And, you know, the companies have tried that kind of stuff, but have, you know, most, I think every job I've ever had, except for maybe one or two, were union places where the union actually was involved with their members. And when the company would come out with some nonsense, there was a response, there was negotiations, there was a voice there. Now you've got this situation with the Koch brothers where they're inundating their people with propaganda and surprisingly getting them to vote against their own best interests. That's what gets me. And your story that was released this week, that the Koch brothers have started this website, Koch Facts, where basically they're buying ads against things they disagree. They've decided that they're going to fight it against every story about them, true or not true. It doesn't matter how true the story is. They're going to put some propaganda against it. And I started thinking that maybe this is how our media structure is going to evolve. You're no longer going to have people reporting news. You're no longer going to have newspapers who do objective journalism or any type of reporting. You're going to have paid stories. So on every page, whoever can afford to put the story in the paper, whoever can get to afford to put the story on the evening news or afford to put it on the radio, they're the ones who are going to be able to get their message out. And who is that? Oh, yeah, the corporations. Because they own the media. They own the newspapers. And I love this frame that there's this liberal media bias out there, which I've yet to really find. I mean, even the so-called liberal New York Times, I don't find all that liberal. I find them to be spewing the same company line. And that's what's kind of interesting to me, is that we've been shaded by very, very slight differences. You know, Democrats and Republicans, you know, they're, for the most part, when it comes to issues like trade, seem to be reading off the same page. When you talk about labor issues, for the most part, they're in the same ballpark. Now, the Walkers of the world, the Kasichs of the world, the Snyders of the world, the folks who want to take away collective bargaining, they've gone a little bit beyond the Republican Party, and the Republican Party has followed. The question is, have the Democrats followed? And there's part of me that looks at this, Jake, and goes, I haven't seen a visceral, strong, heated response from many Democrats. There have been some. You look at the 14 in Wisconsin, the ones in Indiana. You got to give them all the credit in the world. But as a nation, as a Democratic Party, I haven't seen it.
In general, I think you're right. I think what it has done, though, Rick, is internally at least, it has fired up a lot of rank-and-file union members, and that's good to see. But this is just the beginning. It can't be just a spontaneous outpouring of emotion and then quit. It has to be a starting point, not an ending point.
Yeah, but I go back to this, and I'm grabbed by how, you know, the right has taken on to this frame that, you know, we need to be more business friendly, and I'm really stuck on this. And if you can explain it to me, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, this idea that somehow we need to be even more business friendly than we already are, and I would argue that we're already too accommodating to the needs of the multinationals. We're already too accommodating to whatever their needs are. How much more do we have to do? And if you can explain why going down this path even further is in our best interest, I'd love to hear it, because I'm not seeing how destroying family-sustaining jobs, destroying our standard of living, destroying our environment, I'm just not seeing how destroying our educational system, privatizing that, I'm just not seeing how all of that is going to make for a better society. Now, I get the whole idea that the Republicans believe that they're the grand individuals. I get that. That everything should be up to the individual. I get that to a degree. But at the end of the day, if you've got this mentality that it's all about me, your society is going to have, like we have now, mass inequity and massive inequality. And what does that turn a society into? I think it's chaotic. I think it's a violent society, even more than we are now.
And what's even more dangerous, and I've heard this sentiment, you know, the problem with jobs leaving the country is because, well, there's too many regulations. There's too many unions. Not that we've had misplaced priorities, not that the corporate structure in this country has dominated Congress with their oceans of money. But the problem is that we're overregulated, which is absolute nonsense. We're taxed too much, which is absolutely on nonsense. I mean, we just had a report last night. Lowest taxes are the lowest in 40 years.
60 years.
60? Okay.
Years.
I stand corrected. It's been a while. Let's put it that way.
But, you know, they've got us buying these frames. We're taxed enough already. Lowest in 60 years. Taxed enough already. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6 foot six and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John. Big John, Big John, Big Bad John.
Did anybody tell you you can sing?
Yes, I have been told I have a good voice.
Yeah, most likely by yourself.
That was many moons ago, though. You know, kind of like when you were younger and you sang in a group, Rick. Remember that?
I never said I sang. Again, there you go.
Oh, I thought you said did occasionally.
I screamed.
Oh.
There's a huge difference between singing and screaming.
I stand corrected.
That is normal. Anyway, there's a trade fight going on, a trademark fight going on right now in California. A couple of the wineries out there have filed suit claiming that they want the word mommy. Evidently, they are going to declare on their bottle of wine. One says they want to make their wine mommy juice, and another one wants the trademark of mommy's time out. Again, it's kind of funny. They're trying to monopolize the word mommy. Anyway, the owner of mommy's time out declined to comment on the lawsuit. But again, you know, I guess, you know, at the end of the day, you need to have your little glass. You know, back in the 60s, Mother's Little Helper was always the little pill there. Anyway, I was looking at this website that I like. It's PolitiFact.com by the St. Petersburg newspaper. And again, I've heard this frame often, that every time we cut taxes, revenues have gone up and the economy has grown. And the latest one is Republican Congressman from Illinois, Joe Walsh, who was Sunday on This Week with Christiane Amanpour. And basically, he came out and said, look, every time we've done it, it's created more jobs. They have ruled this as flat-out false, because it is flat-out false. It's one of these things that they seem to want to believe. It's the linchpin of their entire ideology that tax cuts will make everything better. If we cut taxes, everything will be wonderful because people will spend and, you know, it'll all come back. And it doesn't work that way. And in fact, the reality is you look at the Clinton years when they actually raised taxes, that's what brought revenue up. That's what helped us begin to pay off the national debt and lower the deficit. And I still go back to Alan Greenspan saying, you know, what are we going to do? We have no idea what to do. We're going to pay the debt off so fast because of these tax increases and because of the Clinton economy. We've got no clue. And then in 2000, we made the wrong choice at the ballot box, and we ended up with a guy who said, here, take all of that surplus and give it away. You know, the surplus that was going to pay off the debt, all that money that was going to, you know, going to make us a debt-free nation. Stop and think, in the 10 years that this has happened, we could have been, for the most part, we could have been debt-free by now. But instead, we're talking about massive austerity programs. We're talking about slashing and burning our safety net. Why? Because we have what I'm calling is the conservative scorched earth policy. This idea that we have to create a crisis, and then and only then can and will the American people submit. And it's what they want. They want us giving up Social Security. They want us giving up on Medicare and on Medicaid. Why? Because there's a lot of profit in this stuff for them. There's a lot of profit in people's suffering. And again, you know, it's nice to see that the people over at Political Fact said, you know what, this is just flat out false. This idea that every time we cut taxes, revenue goes up, the economy has grown. It's false. It's false. But yet I get people all the time, Jake, all the time calling me and say, well, you know, during the Reagan years when they cut taxes, you know, they had more revenue. Then why did Ronald Reagan raise taxes five times? Then why did Ronald Reagan dream up the whole Social Security Trust Fund thing? A massive tax increase. If it did what you say it does, which create more revenue. Why did they do that? Why did those tax handouts create more recession? Oh, I don't know. See, when you stop and you really think about it, when the government pulls back, which Republicans want us to do now, they want the federal government to pull back their spending. You got a governor here in Pennsylvania wants to pull back state spending. That pulls it back from everyone. And it's a slowing down of the economy. Can we right now really afford to slow down? Can we really afford to put the brake, to slam on the brakes, which is what the Republicans want? They want both feet on the brake pedal, and they want you standing on it. Because when we do what they're saying they want to do, which is to slash spending to help, you know, people who are unemployed, slash spending to help women, infant, and children, slash all of the programs that they want to destroy, and then take that money and hand it to the wealthy people in the hopes that maybe possibly if we're nice enough and we're exploitable enough that they'll maybe create a job or two, when we know that's never going to happen either. They're going to create jobs overseas because, look, our minimum wage is still higher than doing business in China or India. And this, they have really, really brainwashed the American people. And I'm frustrated and angered by the fact that you sit and you talk with people who seem to be fairly rational, and they just throw this stuff out like it's, well, as a matter of fact, didn't you know? Did you not know that cutting taxes creates jobs? Did you not know that, you know, the very wealthy pay all the taxes in the country? Did you not know? I mean, I've heard that talking point on taxes a number of times. And in the next segment, we talk with Joshua Holland from Alternet. This is what we're going to talk about. Who pays the taxes? Where is it coming from? What's the big lie? And the big lie, in my opinion, is this, well, half the people pay no taxes. I pay my taxes because we all look at ourselves and go, look at my paycheck. Oh, my gosh, I'm paying all these taxes and all those other people. One out of every two people that I see, they pay nothing. And that's what they want you doing. Because this way you can divide people. This way you can manipulate them. The reality is that only about 10% of the people pay nothing. Only about 10%.
But we never hear that. We always hear that big number, 47% pay zero. Never mind the Social Security, never mind the excise, never mind all those other federal taxes we pay. Never mind that. Because it's a good talking point. It's a good angering point. It's a good divisive point. I mean, how many times have you heard that recently?
All the time. In fact, it's perpetuated by the talk show host, the National Conservative Talk Show. I just heard it last week. And they go on and on and on about, well, you know, the wealthy pay most of the taxes. By the way, they include the wealthy. What they're talking about is anybody that makes over $250,000. What they blithely ignore is the fact that the Bush tax cuts concentrated most heavily in the top 1%, prop 2%, actually. So they paint with a broad brush, and their facts are a little skewed, and their conclusions are dead wrong. But other than that,
You know, at the end of all this, and it's one of those things that kind of grabs my attention. We have become such a very simple-minded, simplistic, sloganeering society. I don't want slogans, and I'm not very good at making them up. I want to have an honest discussion about how do we move this country forward? How do we do what my parents' generation did for us, which is leave us a place where we could prosper and do a little bit better than them? How do my kids do a little bit better than I've done? How do their children do better? How do we continue that, which has been our history? How do we continue it? I don't think by having jobs leave the country, I don't think by having a tax code that benefits the very wealthy so that they can move more overseas, I don't think trade agreements like with Panama to become another tax shelter for multinationals is a great idea. And I sure don't think places like Delaware and their P.O. boxes is a good thing for Pennsylvania. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's the people with the money who decide all of this stuff. And that's where I think Citizens United did one of the greatest disservices to this country, but that's what it was supposed to do.
In a case that probably should have never been heard.
Well, I mean, it was decided law beforehand. You know, whatever happened to balls and strikes. And in actuality, it should have never happened before, because if I remember the case that they're basing all of this on, it was just a footnote put in by a clerk. It wasn't even actually the decision in the Santa Clara case. It was just a footnote that was written in by a clerk who had been a former railroad foreman. I mean, you know, again, you know, and those are the people who wanted to be people. Those are the corporations that wanted personhood. You know, sometimes it's enraging. You know, where folks buy these frames without thought, and then regurgitate them ad nauseum. I mean, I have heard that half the people don't pay taxes. In fact, the top 1% pay 60% of all the taxes in the country. Did you ever stop and think about the fact that they've got half of the wealth? Did you ever stop and think about that they control 60% of the wealth? And no, that's not what we think about. Which is why, again, we need a rational discussion in this country, not the hyperbole that we hear on the right, not the finger pointing and screaming that we hear from the Becks and the Limbaughs, but actually discussion. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk with Joshua Holland from Alternate, also the author of the book, The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America. Right back after this.
I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham. By 2015, 36,000 auto factory jobs will be added at the Detroit 3 automakers, boosting the current UAW membership of 102,000 active auto workers at Ford, GM, and Chrysler in the U.S. Those jobs are expected to be so-called Tier 2 new hires, meaning they'll get about half the pay of veteran UAW auto workers. The UAW is in talks this year on a new domestic auto contract. The union recently announced a membership increase from 35,191 in 2009 to 376,612 in 2010. That's way down from the historic high of 1.5 million members reached in 1979. But the UAW says it hopes to keep growing in 2011 and beyond with new organizing. As the UAW negotiates a new contract this year, the likely target company will be Ford, the most profitable of the Detroit Three, and the only automaker where UAW members still have the right to strike. UAW President Bob King has said he's looking to make sure that workers who gave big concessions to save the U.S. auto industry can now share in the upside that these auto companies are now enjoying. New Jersey's Republican governor is moving to take more money from public workers' paychecks, Jesse Russell reports.
The administration of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has introduced his proposal for requiring state employees to pay more toward health care costs. On average, the New Jersey workforce currently pays roughly 8% of health care premiums. But under Christie's proposal, by 2014, employees will be paying on average 30% of the contribution. The plan will be phased in over 3 years, with an increase to 10% this July, to 17% in January 2012, 23% in January 2013, and the full 30% by July 2014. Democrats also have a plan that would phase in greater health care contributions based on salaries. The proposal was introduced by State Senate President Stephen Sweeney and would be rolled out over 7 years. According to Sweeney's contribution scale, workers making over $100,000 per year would pay 30% by the seventh year, while those making less than $30,000 per year would pay 12%.
In Wisconsin, recall petitions have now been turned in for 3 of the 8 Republican state senators targeted for voting to gut collective bargaining for public workers. State Senator Luther Olson joins Senators Dan Kopanky and Randy Hopper on Wisconsin's recall list. Petitions to recall a 4th senator are expected to be turned in soon. Right-wingers are also trying to get recall elections against 8 of the Wisconsin Democratic senators who stalled the anti-union bill by going to Illinois. But so far, no recall petitions have been filed against any Democrats. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Right, that nice job there, Brett. Nice job. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Wow, that, some great intro music there. Work on that next time. Anyway, my girlfriend was on with George Stephanopoulos, Michelle Bachman, said if we taxed 100% of what everyone made who makes $250,000 or more, everything they made, that would get us about 6 months worth of revenue. That's her frame. And again, it's one of these false premises that they love to throw out there that we could take it all and it still wouldn't matter. But we should take some of it so that over the long haul, maybe we could pay it back. Yeah, kind of like you do with your mortgage, kind of just maybe thought. But I got to tell you that all of these frames that they keep throwing out there, we're not hearing anyone, on the right being honest about. That's why I've asked Joshua Holland. He's written a great book. And he's also the senior editor. Editor and senior writer over at Alternate. Great book, The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America. Joshua, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, I look at this frame that they keep throwing out, and Bachman came up with this zinger today. If we took everything that people making over $250,000 a year we could just run the government for six months.
Yeah, I mean, it's incomprehensible. I don't even know what she's talking about. I assume that she means if no other taxes were collected. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean,
does anybody know what she's talking about?
I generally know.
This kind of reminds me of the conservative argument that you always hear when you talk about raising the minimum wage, say, a dollar, and they say, well, if you raise it to $40 an hour, that would be great, but no jobs would remain. It's like, okay, but we're not talking about raising it to $40 an hour.
Exactly.
And you know, hyperbolic arguments. I find that the you know, for the most part, and I talk about this in the book, conservatives, they like to basically speak in abstractions when they're talking about economic policy, you know, and they'll talk about sending jobs, job killing, everything that's a even mildly progressive as far as public policy is a job killing proposal, right? So it's not that they don't want to do it. It's that it'll kill jobs. What does that mean? Well, we never get to the specifics. Or they couch it all in this kind of airy, you know, abstractions like economic freedom and liberty. And what does that mean when you get right down to it? Well, the people who are talking about that are talking about the freedom to, for companies to pollute, to exploit their workers, et cetera, et cetera. It's not an identifiable notion of freedom that you or I would see.
Yeah, it's the freedom for the Koch brothers to take more and my children to starve.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's freedom. You know, that right now we're in this kind of period where there's such a powerful regressive movement in this country that they're relitigating battles that I thought that we had settled 100 years ago. I mean, they're trying to dilute child labor laws.
Yep.
I mean, that is not a moderate center-right approach to governance when you're saying, listen, let's let children work.
Yeah, I've, as I've said a number of times, they're trying to repeal the entire 20th century. Go back to the good old days.
I mean, in a sense, that's what is so refreshing about the Republican budget, the budget that the House passed last week. Everybody's calling it the Ryan plan. I think it's the Republican plan now that they've all voted for it. It's concrete. It's specific. It tells you exactly what, you know, rather than saying freedom and entitlement reform in vague terms, it's putting out very specific proposals. And the one thing that I'll say, you know, you hear this every day, it's courageous. It is courageous to propose something that overwhelming majorities of Americans oppose, and that's just what they've done.
Is that courageous or just plain stupid?
Well, we'll see in November of 2012. I believe that they have overreached dramatically. I wrote a piece this week. You know, it's very difficult when you're a true believer, when your movement is filled with true believers who actually believe their own spin. You know, think about conservative rhetoric. This is something that I think a lot about. They've identified themselves as kind of the stewards of the American mainstream. Remember Sarah Palin's Real America versus, you know, the fake America that liberals inhabit. And they believe that the American people are very much on their side, that they hate government. And so, you know, I believe that they believe that these policies are ultimately not going to destroy them politically. I don't see how, you know, how this is going to fly as far as if we have an educated public come November 2012. Well, I think they're going to be spanked very hard for their...
That's a big if.
Their overreach. Well, look in Wisconsin. I mean, that was the buyer's remorse. It's already showing in the polls.
Yeah, well, we're seeing the numbers across the states. I mean, Kasich's numbers are down. Corbett's, you know, Tom Corbett's numbers are down here. You see Scott's numbers down. Snyder's numbers. Kasich, they're actually talking about. Snyder, they're actually talking about recall. Same thing with Kasich.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yes, absolutely. And if Walker were eligible for recall, I think in Wisconsin, under the Wisconsin laws, he's not eligible until next year.
Right.
He would be on that list as well. And you see it in the national polls. Swing voters, of course, went dramatically for Republicans in the 2010 midterms. And when you look at that group of voters, the swing voters, they have changed their mind. They have significant buyer's remorse because they believed, the Republican line that they were going to protect Medicare and create jobs and focus on the economy. And what they've done is really threatened Medicare and passed no jobs bills. You know, we're getting assault on NPR and Planned Parenthood. This is a socially conservative agenda. And, you know, the swing voters are saying, wait a second, what did we get ourselves into?
Right. Paul Ryan come to your door?
Yeah, that was my my dog.
Glad you got him.
Whenever I talk about Paul Ryan, she just gets flustered.
Good for her.
Yes, I've trained her.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Joshua Holland. He is the editor and senior writer over at Alternet, a great website, alternet.org. He is also the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America. You know, with tax day having come and gone, the right has really latched on to this frame that, well, you know, half of the people in the country, they don't pay any federal income tax. They're all free riders, all of those people.
Yeah, I find this one of the most pernicious lies out there. You know, there's a kernel of truth, which is that the federal income tax is among the most progressive taxes we have in this country. So it is true that a relatively large share of the population don't pay federal income tax. So if you take that reality and you pretend that the federal income tax are the only taxes we're paying, that's an inherently dishonest narrative. And the reality, the real truth here is that only $1 out of $5 collected by the government is the federal income tax. Now, when you look at other taxes, they're far more regressive. So if you look at people who are earning a lower income, the biggest tax that they pay tends to be payroll taxes. If you look at sales taxes, they're regressive. If you look at excise taxes, so those are those so-called sin taxes on cigarettes and alcohol, they're very regressive. State income taxes, we don't have them in every state, but they're often less progressively structured. And when you add all those taxes, and I cite research in the book to this effect, we're all paying more or less in the same range of taxes, poor or rich. $20,000 of income to $1 million of income if you add up all of the different taxes we pay, you get a range of about 10 percentage points. So, I mean, it's such a ludicrously misleading charge. And of course, it's used for a political agenda. When these stories come out, Rush Limbaugh goes on and says, well, see, those liberals are always talking about tax cuts for the rich. The rich are the only people paying taxes. It's a big lie.
But it works well. I got to be honest. I have to give the right credit. They know how to do the simple-minded sloganeering to get average everyday people who really aren't filtering. They're just regurgitating to just continue to put this stuff out. I mean, I had a guy today tell me this exact same thing. Well, you know, half the people don't pay taxes, and the top 1%, they pay 60% of the taxes. You just want to soak the rich even more.
Yes, I mean, they're very effective in their messaging, and they have a lot of structural advantages when it comes to that. They've invested a lot in what I call alternative information infrastructure. So they've developed a whole series of think tanks. They've invested a lot of money in media, which helped them amplify this. But they also are, I think, very sophisticated when it comes to exactly what you were talking about, making it simple, making it appeal to emotion. And this is a big problem we face in our discourse. You get people like me explaining, and you get people like Frank Luntz figuring out how to appeal to the heartstrings. And I think that there is some inequality on that. That's an uneven playing field when you have a lot of low-information voters, so-called low-information voters in your electorate.
Like it's like any campaign you'll ever run, if you're explaining, you're losing.
That's it. You are losing. And, you know, we spend a lot of time explaining. I don't really know what the alternative is. There are certainly people in the progressive movement who are thinking about better messaging. It's not something that we tend to do in terms of we don't have so-called message discipline. Part of that is just the nature of the ideology. We're very individualistic. We don't take top-down message dictums very well.
Right. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you hit it on the head. They have invested a lot of money in media, and they project this. We're being persecuted. We're the underdog, even though, the corporate control of the media seems to be, well, I mean, seems to be in hand. I mean, I read six corporations own 80% of everything we see, hear, and read.
And you can see it when you talk about issues like trade coverage, right? Trade policy. It's one of the, I would argue, one of the areas of public policy that is covered the most poorly by the mainstream media. And, you know, I don't want to say that there's any kind of directives coming from the executive suite, you know, don't cover this, but there is a kind of cultural tendency to not present that issue in a terribly balanced way. And both sides have the experience of seeing the media, and of course media is more diverse than that, biased against them. Because I do believe that conservatives are right if they're saying that the media, which is, you know, based by and large in coastal large cities, doesn't agree with them about abortion or gay rights. You know, the media, these are urbanites. These are coastal urbanites. And I can see how they can look at that and say, wait a second, they're not covering our wing nuttery fairly. That's a little bit different from economic policy.
Yeah, I agree with that. But at the end of the day, it seems like they're all reading off the same script when it comes to the moneyed interests.
Yes.
Especially this half of the people pay no tax thing. I mean, it is everywhere.
Look at the way they've covered these conflicts over public employees unions. I mean, how many times have you seen a news story that goes out of its way to point out that that has absolutely nothing to do with deficit reduction? I mean, you look at there are eight states where public employees don't have collective bargaining rights, and if you look at those states and their finances, a handful of them are in the worst condition.
South Carolina being one of them.
Several of them are among the ones that have, I think it was 10% more budget deficits to close. So, you know, yet the mainstream media does this, a great service by conflating those issues, by writing story after story after story, where they talk in the same news story about cutting public workers' ability to negotiate and cutting deficits.
At the end of this, though, I think it has to come down to people on the left, people, the progressives, investing in media and promoting sites like alternet.org, because I think you guys just do some excellent work over there with some great writing. But I think it comes down to, and unfortunately, I think it's gonna, our media is going to be where you're going to end up having each side paying for their positions.
Well, it works in England, right? I mean, there is something to be said for media that does not try to always split the difference, because you can really get even reading both sides, you get a better picture than if you read a so-called neutral report that doesn't try to mediate between truth and spin.
Right. Good point. Joshua.
And we're spun to death. I mean, just turn on CNN any day. You know, we are spun to death.
Exactly, and you can make up anything you want there. Joshua Holland, editor and senior writer over at alternet.org, also the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy. You can get the book at there's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Take you over to Powell's to pick that up. Josh, I appreciate your time. Keep up the great work over there.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
House Speaker John Boehner, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and Budget Chairman Paul Ryan like to portray themselves as the three budgeteers. Decrying deficits, the GOP's sharp-eyed slashers of federal spending are galloping through Congress with swords flashing, severing billions, nay, trillions, from the national budget. Medicare for seniors, behead it. Food stamps for the poor, whack 'em. Environmental protections, eviscerate 'em. Consumer agency, kill it. Practically all of the slash and burn rampage by the three budgeteers comes at the expense of America's middle class and the poor. For corporate powers and the wealthy elites, however, the dynamic trio offers more governmental gimmies, including a one-third cut in their tax rates. The budgeteers are also demanding that government workers take cutbacks. But wait, aren't Boehner, Cantor, and Ryan workers too? Well, yes, but very special workers. So when they recently took our government to the brink of a total shutdown, who they rushed to protect? Not emergency responders, toxic waste cleanup crews, air traffic controllers, or millions of other federal employees we count on, but themselves. In the Senate, Barbara Boxer had passed a bill to suspend the paychecks of all Congress critters if the government shuts down. But the three budgeteers blocked it in the House.
thus protecting the $174,000 a year that each lawmaker sucks from us taxpayers. But then, the GOP threesome cynically tried to trick the public about their perfidy. They made a show of approving a House version of the congressional pay suspension, but tucked into a bill with zero chance of passing. This is Jim Hightower saying, Boehner, Cantor, Ryan, remember those names. They think they're clever, and they are hoping that you are stupid.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick at therickssmithshow.com. You know, you look around the country and you see all of these Republican governors who took, you know, like Rick Scott there in Florida, Walker there in Wisconsin, Kasich in Ohio, our guy Corporate here in Pennsylvania, Christie in New Jersey, all, you know, going after the federal government, saying the federal government spends too much. We need to cut spending. Yet what's kind of odd is while they're attacking the federal spending, they don't seem to have a problem with taking federal funds. They've been filling their budget holes with some federal money here. And what I find amazing is that our mainstream media kind of just turns a blind eye to it. You look at it right here, the $300 million from the Federal Education Jobs Fund that Corbett is going to use in his budget to pay for basic education while reducing the state by the same amount. And you go across the budgets and you start looking at how they finagle this stuff. And really, they're no different. I would say that they're worse. The idea that, and this is what bothers me about Ryan's idea for Medicaid. This idea that we're going to hand out a bunch of block grants, that we're going to say here, Medicaid is up to the states. We're going to, much like the welfare programs, here's some block money, here's some grant money, go and set up your own program. Well, what, just like what happened with welfare, you saw a lot of that money being diverted elsewhere as they made things harder to access. They made programs harder to get enrolled in. They made the requirements much more difficult. And they were able to take that money and move it elsewhere. And what bothers me is they were able to then go back to the voters and say, look, we didn't raise your taxes at all on the backs of those who could least stand up for themselves, which is what's going on here. Corbett cut off the adult basic thing. He's going after education. He's going after, you know, a bunch of cuts to programs that, you know, kind of make you go, that's your priority? I mean, $1 billion from education, that's a priority of a pro-business person? I'm not getting it. All under the guise of, you know, things are tough. We need to cut spending. I'm having a difficult time with that.
Well, and here's another problem. And the last couple of nights, I gave reports on school districts right around here, Rick. It's not just the fact that he's withholding $1 billion. It's this idea that then some of these school boards and they're held hostage to the variances of who gets elected, Rick. And if you get a conservative school board, they will use this fiscal crisis, which they have, to cut into programs which probably you and I wouldn't consider marginal. We consider it part of the sinew of a good educational program. And we just talked about one of the school districts in this county who started to do that. And that's another problem which we don't even talk about. It's a problem behind a problem, and it's just unconscionable what they're doing to education in this state. And if we keep going that way, I mean, God knows how many years it'll be before we can get back to where we should be.
Now, look, I understand we've got some spending issues, both on the state level and on the federal level. You cannot continue to borrow long term at the pace that we're borrowing. But at some point, you have to say, well, we can't right now pull back too quickly, which is what the Republicans are really talking about, and really a slamming on the brakes. And what's that going to do to this recovery, which has taken some time? It has slowly grown. And I don't think anybody, after the big Bush collapse, thought that this was going to come back overnight. And I kind of blame the president for not being out there more, saying, look, you know, it's coming on. You know, we dug out of a massive hole. I think had he gone out more and said what was what, I think we'd be in a different position politically. But I think, you know, again, he got rabbit ears. He allowed the Republicans to start controlling the message. And he got beat up in the media. And I think this is now time for folks to look at these budgets that Republicans have put out, because I do believe they're moral documents. I do believe they're important ways of looking at priorities. And across the board, the priority is slash education. The priority is to steal wages from families. The priority is to take a voice away from workers. That's their priority. The other priority is to hand more to those who are doing already very, very well in the hopes. And I don't even know anymore if they buy the hope that it's going to create jobs. I don't. I don't think they buy that anymore, because it hasn't really happened. I mean, Bush kept telling us, oh, we cut taxes, we're going to create jobs. Didn't happen. So I've yet to find that, where you've cut taxes on the very, very wealthy, and it has created jobs. Now, understand, had you taken that money, that $1.7 trillion, and targeted it towards the middle of the middle and the bottom of the income, I think that would have created jobs, because you'd have put money in people's pockets. My problem with that, though, is I think you'd have created jobs in China. Because consumers would have gone to the store and said, well, what's the cheapest price? Oh, this cheap crap from China. And they would have bought that. What we should have done with that tax dollars, with that $1.7 trillion, and the Lord knows how much we've wasted over there in the sandbox. What we should have done with that is, you know what? We're going to rebuild those crumbling bridges. We're going to invest in education. We're going to invest in research and development. We're going to invest in infrastructure. That would have spent money in a very targeted way, would have put people back to work who are paying back into the coffers. It would have been something that we would have, something tangible that we would have for years to come, something that would have created a place for business to thrive. But what we did during the Bush years is, here, Jake, here's a check for $300. Go shopping. And it doesn't work. Because what that money did, and look, we learned it back in the 70s when Ford gave out the handout. I think Ford gave out about a check for about $200, if you probably remember. He learned, you know what we learned from that? The propensity for new consumption did not increase one bit. People took that check, paid bills, just like they did during the Bush years. My checks, I do believe, ended up on my mortgage, if I remember correctly. And to be honest, I don't even know what happened to it. I think it just was absorbed into the general fund, which I then put on the mortgage. But at the end of the day, there was no new consumption. I didn't run out with my Bush handout and go, oh boy, I'm going to get those new golf clubs.
It was just like working a couple extra hours at work, you know, having a little bit extra in your check.
And, you know, you go back to this and you go, how do you stimulate an economy? Well, we figured that out during the Roosevelt years. You invest in infrastructure. To me, that's the key to this, and we still haven't done enough of it. To me, we go back and we say, you know what, you've been unemployed for 26 weeks? Well, starting the day after your 26th week, obviously you're not going to find a job doing what you're doing, so we're going to hire you at $100 above what you were making, $150, whatever. We're going to give you some health care, and you're going to learn how to build a bridge. You're going to do some day labor stuff. You're going to work at building projects to put this country on the path to the 21st century.
You know, more economists should teach, if you want a prototype of the way the economy should be, this, our economy coming out of the 50s and the 60s, where you had us putting back about 12% of our income into infrastructure. You had union membership increasing at a great rate. You had jobs being created, and it was like a giant snowball And as time went on, you created more and more and more wealth, and all that wealth that was created in the workplace was then funneled back in the economy, creating even more jobs. It's a pretty simple concept. But yet, when was the last time you heard the Republicans talking about investing back into our economy? When?
And what I think we need here in this area, public transportation. I mean, you drive around this area.
That's a no-brainer.
Over the next 10 years, Cumberland County, Dauphin County is going to continue to grow. And we're going to continue to sell off farmland. We're going to continue to landlock ourselves to where we're not going to be able to have the ability to put in public transportation.
And if they would have done that when they should have, right now, we probably would have started building the darn thing.
And, hey, you know, maybe when gas is 10 bucks a gallon, maybe we'll start thinking about it. Maybe our visionless leaders will decide, you know, maybe that's not such a bad idea. We should think about it. Commission a study.
That was a situation where some of the Democrats voted it through the Republicans, and what was the issue again? Well, we don't want to raise taxes.
Anyway, let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Message is brought to you by SEIU Local 668.
My name is Lewis. I help senior citizens get the services they need. I work for you, the taxpayers, in the Area Agency on Aging. Our senior population is growing. Their incomes are shrinking. Their need for government services is increasing, all at the same time. Funding for these services is not keeping pace, which means long waiting lists, huge caseload, and more seniors at risk. We all know that these are tough economic times, but who wants to see our senior citizens suffer? They did their part. They worked hard and paid their taxes. Now it's our turn to make sure they get the services they need. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they respect our senior citizens and vote to increase funding for programs that protect them.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out our website at TheRickSmithShow.com. And now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time
Thank
for us.
Thank you so much.
More movement on the Defense of Marriage Act stuff, right?
Well, that's right. Essentially what happened is Boehner hired somebody, a law firm, to deal with these cases that have come before on Defense of Marriage Act, and to essentially say that, you know, Congress shouldn't be doing this, and that it should be able to work across state lines and all that kind of stuff. And Boehner hired a contractor, a lawyer contractor, and is paying him $500,000.
Beautiful. See, the Republicans have lived up to their campaign pledge. They created a job.
That's right. Well, not only that, Rick Smith, when you really think about it, I mean, here are these guys, they're trying to save money, and they're spending $500,000 on the Defense of Marriage Act. Oh, my gosh, I can't wait till I see Boehner again.
But you got to understand, this is political grandstanding. And they did. They created one job. I mean, granted, it's for probably a brother-in-law who needed a job, but, you know, it's still a job.
Well, what's interesting is Nancy Pelosi really sent him a letter going through chapter and verse about government ethics and all this kind of thing, but $500,000.
I mean, I got to be honest with you. This is just, to me, so stupid. It's such a waste of time. I'm sorry. At the end of this, you know, like my grandfather, I said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. This is one of those issues. I don't care what my neighbors are doing. I don't care what the people down the street are doing. I just don't. If two guys want to get married, two women want to get married, good luck. Hope it works out for you.
Exactly. $500,000 in this environment, quite staggering.
How about worrying about the 50 to 75% of the marriages that end up in divorce after 5 to 7 years? Why don't you try working on that first? When you've perfected marriage, then you can do something with it.
Good point. And maybe they ought to put some of that money into, a lot of those classes that they have married couples take, et cetera.
No.
Just plain dumb to me. And it's such a waste of time. We should be working out how do we rebuild our infrastructure? How do we make sure that our communities are safe? How do we create jobs? That's where we should be spending our time. The FCC is back in the news again.
FCC is back in the news today. Yes, actually, I believe it's called the Economic Club or whatever. It's a group of business people in Washington, D.C. And the head of the FCC spoke about this. Spoke today before the group, and it's very interesting. He's actually somebody who Obama's known for years, played basketball with him. His name is Julius Jankowski. And he said, look, we need to get more spectrum. We need to get more bandwidth. He said, just apps have added $38 billion to the economy, that smartphones use 25 times the amount of bandwidth. Tablets use 145 times the amount than just a plain cell phone does. And he said, if we can manage to actually take what's happening with these people and sell off the spectrum and then give the people who are selling at the TV stations, et cetera, a piece of the action, there will be much more spectrum available. He also said something really interesting. Do you know that if you are in a situation, you cannot text 911? And he said, this is a terrible situation. People can't text them. They have to call them. And if you're taking a photograph of a bank robber or somebody in a serious accident, pile up or something, he said, you should be able to text a photograph or get a photograph to 911.
Sure.
But you can't do it in our current technology.
Well, again, the failure to invest in it. It sounds to me what you're saying then is they want to privatize the 911 system.
Well, I don't think our government wants to. I think what they want to do is actually figure out a way to work with it, but he has to bring Republicans along, and there has to be congressional money.
So the pound of flesh is we're going to privatize some of it.
Right.
Because what we're doing now is we're just consolidating, and while I think it's great for the workers of T-Mobile who are going to be able to unionize, I'm not in favor of more consolidation of the web and more consolidation of wireless service. I think we've got too much consolidation.
Well, he was asked about that, actually, and he said that he couldn't comment on that because, of course, there was a Comcast, and I guess there are some other things before the FCC that are coming up.
Well, at the end of this, Comcast is going to own everything. So I've come to that realization. They're going to.
I used to think they were a little itty-bitty company,
yeah,
but they're not.
not anymore. A possible executive order, something I think might be a good idea.
Well, yes, and I mean, this executive order is really this issue of what is going to be happening with the possibility that somehow they are going to force companies who, under the current Senate rules and the current Supreme Court, don't have to disclose people that they're giving money to, all those sort of, I think, the 501c4s or whatever they are, that they don't have to, give, who are doing campaign videos and all that stuff. And under the executive order, the president wants to sign. And according to the press secretary, it's being worked on now, that in order to get government contracts, you would have to disclose where this money is coming from.
I'm all in favor of that.
We all are.
I mean, you look at GE, you look at ExxonMobil, you look at these huge multinational corporations making billions in profit, and not only are they paying zero taxes, we're actually paying them for the privilege of working for them.
Right.
It's just amazing stuff. Some new Homeland Security rules?
That's right. Basically, there's going to be two levels, and they're going to last only 2 weeks before they're either renewed or something. These levels are going to be elevated or imminent, and they would have to refer, imminent would refer to a specific and impending terrorist attack. There may be some levels that are not issued publicly but are given to a specific industry or business, like perhaps the airline industry or something, and is not made public.
Well, that's a big change from the color-coded system that they used to scare the hell out of the American people with.
For sure, and I think it's a very good change, Charlie.
I do too. I mean, you go, our former governor here in Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge, yeah, they made me jerk that thing all up and down to get people all worried for nothing.
Right.
Amazing stuff. Good news, Helen. Good. I appreciate the time, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Thank you.
And what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
There's an article about former Representative Patrick Murphy. He is the gentleman who won election to Congress back in 2006, Rick, if you remember that big year election. That was the year that the Democrats in this state made tremendous strides. That was the year that Joe Sestak won, Jason Altomare won. He won that year, and unfortunately, the man that he defeated in Bucks County, a man by the name of Mike Fitzgerald, came back and in 2010 defeated him. So he has decided to run for Pennsylvania Attorney General in 2012. He's a good man. That was a bitter defeat back there, and he stayed around, and I think he'd make an excellent Attorney General. By the way, that traditionally, at least in the last several decades, has been the pure reserve of the Republicans, so it'll be interesting to see what he can do. A decorated war veteran, I think he has a decent shot in 2012. Some latest developments from Wisconsin. Joanne Kloppenburg, who ran for a seat on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court against Republican David Prosser, is calling for a recount of the election results. 5 days after the April 5th election, Kloppenburg was slightly ahead in the polls. Wasisha Clerk, who worked in the state assembly, Republican caucus during the time that Prosser was assembly speaker, mysteriously found 14,000 votes in her computer, giving Prosser a lead of about 7,500 votes. According to the president of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO, and I agree totally with what he said, he said an honest and open recount is the only way that voters of Wisconsin can have confidence in the results of the 2011 Supreme Court election. Manual recount will only add to the integrity of the electoral process and provide reassurance to the unprecedented amount of voters who came out on April 5 to make their voices heard. And I hope that Wisconsin follows up on that for the sake of the people of Wisconsin. Nearly 85% of the transportation security officers are presently voting for a union. The vote is between AFGE, American Federation of Government Employees, and the vote, you can either vote for them or vote for no union or NTEU. That election will be occurring in the next, well, in fact, it did occur, I'm sorry, April 19th. We still didn't get the final election tallies. The AFL-CIO has been asking union members to speak with TSOs whenever they're in an airport and urge them to vote yes for AFGE. It's a long, long time in coming, and I think AFGE has a good chance of winning that election. Here's a story, Rick, that's repeated all too often in the country. There's a group of workers from Consolidated Biscuit. It's a candy maker. That Consolidated Biscuit was bought by Hearthside Food Solutions in Macomb, Ohio. They are a big step closer to joining a union. The National Labor Relations Board announced that 825 workers will vote May 5 and 6 on whether to join a union, and their efforts to join a union were started about 10 years ago. They were fed up with low pay, minimum benefits, and hazardous working conditions. They approached the BCTGM about joining the union way back in 2001. The NLRB overturned an initial election in 2002 because the company, CBC, had repeatedly violated federal labor laws. The labor board ordered the new election more than 2 years ago, and the decision was affirmed by the U.S. 6th District Court of Appeals. Both the NLRB and the appeals court ruled that CBC harassed union organizing activities and confused and scared workers into voting against joining the BCTGM. Since the new company bought out CBN, it has eliminated workers' pensions, increased their health care expenses, and reduced the coverage. Some reported reduced sick time with pay. They changed their schedules, and management favoritism in promotions was exhibited. Some of them were demoted, and they fired some of the people unfairly. They also described unfair working conditions in which workers occasionally lost fingers or suffered broken arms or carpal tunnel syndrome. Last month, workers at the Heathside Cookie Plant in London, which was another plant owned by Heathside, they also expressed an interest in joining the BCTGM and are currently awaiting an election date. Heathside acquired CBC and its facilities in Holcombe and London in 2009. And that's my report, Rick.
All righty, let's take a quick break. We're right back after this to wrap things up.
Freeway ride. But they slashed our funding. They cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. And did I become a problem? How did the fall become online? The president says they're tithing their bill. The only one that's adding is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Tomorrow at noon, we're going to be up in Pottsville, Schuylkill County, with the United Labor Council of Schuylkill County for an informational picket, informational protest there at the Pottsville Club, 201 South 26th Street, there in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. And when we come back tomorrow night, we'll be able to find out exactly what that was about and then bring a couple of people on and talk about the informational protest. As I understand it, the Chamber of Commerce, who I call the GOP hit squad, is coming to town, going to promote their anti-worker agenda. So we will be there to find out what that's about. Also, next Thursday, April 28th, that is Workers' Memorial Day. We, in the working class, at least, you know, in my family, we do take a moment to remember those who were injured or killed on the job. Here in Harrisburg, they're going to be putting on a breakfast, 8 a.m., here in the area, also a memorial service at 9:30, and then a rally at 11 at the Capitol. If you want more information, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, and we'll get you set up with that. I believe the memorial is at 9:30 over at Laborers Grove off of South Front Street there. Here in Harrisburg. So, and also tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, the Carlisle School Board meeting. Going to find out, for me, it's about finding out what cuts are going to come down the road and where they're going to slash. Part of me thinks they're going to go after full day kindergarten, which I think is a horrible idea. Earlier we talked about the article in the Nation magazine, about the Koch brothers. And very quickly, you got to give them credit. Must be all that money that they're spending. They have come out with a response to the article, which I thought was a good article. It was spot on. Talks about the fact that the Koch brothers have used their influence to try and push their employees their way. Anyway, they claim that the materials in the packets are entirely consistent with the law and Koch Industries.
record of public statements in support of free market policies and previously disclosed contributions by Koch PAC to candidates for public office. Basically saying that the laws are stacked in our favor and we're just abusing what's there for us. I mean, what'd you think they were going to say? They've got it going their way. I would say anybody else who their employer is sending out, this is how you should vote notices, you should come forward. I would. Absolutely, I would. Anyway, the other day in Indiana, the Senate voted to ban state funding for Planned Parenthood, and really, I guess, any organization that does any abortion services. The reason I think this is important is there was a Republican, a woman named Vannetta Becker, who stood up and said she didn't understand why the people in the legislature wanted to take money away from women's health services at the same time while cutting funding towards programs for mentally disabled children. Why would you take from programs that are going to help stop unwanted pregnancies, maybe help folks plan when at the same time you're taking money away from programs that help people, help children, especially on the federal level. So she stepped forward and said, I just don't understand. It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand why you would want to do this. Because, you know, at the end of this, if you can prevent it from happening, maybe you're not going to have the abortion after all. And to me, that's the point. The education part, the ability to prevent this stuff from happening, because I don't think anybody's jumping for joy that people have abortions. In fact, she said, quote, if our goal is to prevent abortions, we should not be proposing this. This piece of legislation will increase abortions. Because it's decreasing the amount of money and the amount of access for people to stop it. So good for her. You know, finally a Republican with a brain. You got to give her credit. I had to go all the way to Indiana to find one, which again, kind of surprising there as well. Have you ever been in New York? You see the cabbies who drive around in New York, who I give credit to. I wouldn't want to. I hate driving in New York, and especially when you get lost in some of the more seedy areas, and there are some. Evidently, the New York livery cab drivers, when they go into these areas, they're not. It's like a union. It's a federation. It's the New York State Federation of Taxi Drivers. They have been giving out bulletproof vests. And if you look at their website, they got a really good website. But they're handing out bulletproof vests to any of their drivers that work the night shift. So good for them.
I think it's very practical.
If you have a job and you need to wear a bulletproof vest to work, I think maybe you need to reconsider your job. Unless you're a cop.
I mean, the truth is, those people need their jobs. What are you going to do? Are you going to refuse to go in certain areas? I don't even know if that's legal. If you're given a license, can you do that?
No, I don't think so. But at the end of it, man, you know, you look at some of those areas and you got to wonder. Maybe really thick glass. Anyway, in Ohio, one of the bus services for disabled people, a driver found a wad of cash, about 1,200 bucks, in his vehicle. And you know what happened? He returned it. That's why this is news. Evidently, this guy, Ronald Guy, found a roll of 20s in the bus, and he took it back and said, hey, I found this money on the seat. They returned it to the disabled woman who had lost it because she had just cashed her check. Now they're going to give him a commendation from the transit authority. I'm sure the governor is not going to weigh in on it. Because I'm sure if it were the governor, he'd probably pocket it. And last night we talked about the postal carrier who defecated in one of his people's yards. I still have yet to get comment yet, and I'm still trying to find out what made him defecate in these folks.
Well, it probably was, I think you were right, it was probably behind some bushes somewhere and he just happened to get caught.
It just doesn't say. All it says is the guy who lived in those, he said he started pulling his pants down and started defecating. And at that point, I grabbed my camera and started taking pictures. I don't know that those pictures that I really...
Oh, he took pictures?
Sure he did.
They weren't online, I hope.
Nobody's going to believe you. Well, they should have. You might have made a penny or two off of it.
Oh,
I don't know. I got to be honest. I think I would, I would be too shocked to go run get my camera.
Well, you know, I don't even know if I should say that. Maybe the postman wasn't feeling good. I'm serious. Maybe he was half sick.
Well, it takes me back, and I remember one of those. I used to watch that insane program, Undercover Boss, which I guess is still on. I just got tired of the same. Mm-hmm. It was the same program over and over with just different characters.
Your favorite Sunday night program?
Yeah, I mean it was the same thing over and over and over and over again. You had a couple of people who, you know, they prepared, they scripted, and you know they got a lottery winning at the end. But I remember the one woman from, I guess it was like waste management or something, who had a coffee cup, and she had a coffee can. And this is my bathroom. This is where I go to the bathroom. She did, you know, because where are you going to go? You're driving a garbage truck. It's not like you can pull over anywhere and just go where you need to go. You know, ask any truck driver. Good luck trying to find a place to pull into. Because you look at all of these malls. The first thing all of these shopping malls do is they put those big islands in there. That's not to put trees in and make nice. No, that's to keep trucks out of. That is there strategically to keep truck drivers out of. And they're going to be glad they did as soon as the Mexicans come through.
Well, I mean, all due respect, aren't you know most of you guys are delivering in the back, aren't you, for the most part? In malls? No, I'm serious.
Yeah, but if you've got to find somewhere to go. You know, we're talking about something completely different. You know, if you're going to find somewhere to go, you know.
Well, I mean, they're not. You're right about that. They're not. You know.
They're
not hauling truck friendly. No, you're right. Because why? Because you're hogging about 10 parking spaces. That's so. You know. In other words, Rick, that a mall.
I've seen
mall,
the way you drive.
A mall.
You is, in the car you've got take up 10 spaces.
Are you telling me that I drive Miss Daisy?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, that's a good question. When you're driving a truck, where do you stop?
Wherever you can, I guess. Anyway, our quote of the day comes from E.J. Dionne, the reporter over at the Washington Post. He says, resolving the deficit problem requires the very rich to recognize their obligations to contribute more to the government that, measured against other wealthy nations, is neither investing enough in the future, nor doing a very good job of improving the lives and opportunities of the less affluent. And I agree. And if you want to see what the folks in the upper crust are paying, you can go to remappingdebate.com, which is a web interactive service. And you can go in there, you can put in a whole bunch of numbers. I think it's a great website. I encourage everyone to go over there and just fiddle around with it. It's well worth a couple of minutes to see exactly what our wealth class pays compared to what you pay. It's an interesting exercise and one worth considering. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program today, you go to ricksmithshow.com and download the podcast. Always there for your entertainment and enjoyment. This week we're going to be taking Friday off. We'll be back here tomorrow, but Friday we're taking off for the big holiday. We will have a best of for your enjoyment. We hope you have a great night, and we will see you back here tomorrow, as always.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and endless ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Well, they're stealing down on Wall Street and in Washington, too. No, it makes me wonder what's a guy on Main Street to do. Always tried to be an honest, upstanding kind of guy. But I must admit lately, I thought about giving something else a try. Oh, I want to be a pirate. I want to sail the seven seas. Yeah, I want to be a pirate.
want to do